こんにちは。
こんにちは。
今日は特別編ということでゲストにお越しいただいています。文字起こしのテキストを同時リリースしているのでそちらもチェックしてみてください。慶応義塾大学環境情報学部准教授の荒川和治さんです。イエイ。
ようこそ。
よろしくお願いします。
前にゲストに来てくれた清水さんとか、よく番組に名前が出てくるテルさんとかにずっともう荒川さんを呼んだ方が絶対いい、荒川さんの話を絶対に聞いた方がいいって言われていて、やっと来ていただいたっていう感じなんですけど、ありがとうございます。
光栄です。ありがとうございます。
なんかね、ずっと私荒川さんのこと怖いイメージがあって
なんでですか？
なんかツイッターとかかな。でもお会いしたらめちゃくちゃなんか優しそうで安心しているところなんですけど、勝手に、
はい、Thank you for these wonderful熊まし
ね、早速めっちゃ可愛い、
はい、お持ちいたしました。
めちゃくちゃ可愛いクマムシのぬいぐるみをいただいて、すごい大きいですよね。しかも
そうですね、これが L サイズっていうものにいろんなサイズありまして
なるほど。
マグネットも持ってきたんですけど、マグネットと SML あと XL っていうのがありますね。
Did you make these?
So I'm tying up with this step animal making company. It's called TSC Advance. And they're very famous for making those very realistic, like creature kind of staffed animals. It's very, became famous for the Daiyogusokumushi no nuigurumi.
I have that.
Yeah?
Actually, my mom bought it somewhere at the aquarium.
Oh, yes, yeah.
なんかね、紐引っ張るとブルブル震えるやつなんだけど。でもこれはその荒川さんが実際に発見した庄内長命虫っていう新種のクマムシのぬいぐるみなんですよね。
これが去年の夏ぐらいに新しく発売したやつなんですけども、私が 2,3 年前ですかねに新しく鶴岡で発見した新種のぬいぐるみになってて、ちょっとそのネームカードというかタグのところが少し豪華になっていて、私のコメントがついていたりとか、
すごい、ちゃんと説明が書いて
ある。 Wow, is that you?
Yes, my Twitter icon.
荒川さんの似顔絵がついてるし、
かっこいい。すごい。
クマムシってもう、多分うちの番組でも何回も登場していて、ずっとすごい興味があったんですけど、そもそも動物っていうカテゴリーなんですよね。
そうですね、日本語の動物っていうのは結構哺乳類を指すことが多いんですけど、生物学でいうとこの動物っていうのは動くものが全部動物なんですよ。なので虫とかも動物になりますので、クマムシは動物という生物の分類上はなりますね。なので、どちらかというと日本語だと虫っていう方が合うんでしょうけど、日本語のいわゆる虫っていうものっていうのは昆虫を指すんですよね。で、昆虫っていうのは六本足の節足動物っていう分類になるんですが、クマムシは漢方動物という独自の門を持ってるんですね。門孔木科属種っていう生物の分類がありますけど、その門を持っていると。なので、だいぶいろんな生き物からは離れた系統になるんですが、脱皮動物っていう脱皮する生き物の仲間の、祖先に非常に近いようなものです。昆虫とかも脱皮する生き物ですけど、
漢方動物、tardigrade ってやつ、
ね、tardigrade、ゆるく歩くっていうふうに書くんですね、漢方っていうのが。で、それは同じラテン語でも tardi っていうのが遅いで、grade っていうのが歩くってことなので、遅く歩くものっていうものですね。
なんかその日本語と英語で私の頭の中であんまり一致してなくて、その私の中でタリグレイイコールクマムシって思ってるんですけど、それ正しい？
正しいです。英語だとウォーターベアっていうふうに言いますし、ドイツ語だと、もともとドイツの人が見つけたんですけど、1800年代に。で、これがベアティヘンっていうちっちゃなクマみたいな、そういう。
ワーターベアってすごい可愛いですよね。
そうですね。あとはモスピグレットとかも言われるんですけど、なんかピグレットっていうふうに言われるとちょっと日本人的にはどうなんでしょうね。アメリカ人的には多分可愛い感じだと思うんですけど、
小豚ちゃんみたいな感じ、
苔の小豚っていうふうに言われるとちょっと日本人的にはクマムシの方が可愛いかなっていう。
確かに。
So are they commonly found in moss?
Yes, and they are actually ubiquitous. They are everywhere. They're found in the top of the Himalayas and also found in the deep seasAnd you can obviously find it when you're walking down the streets, and there are mosses stuck onto the like the concrete walls and concrete.
Are there any in here in this room?
I don't think so. Not in the house, but maybe in the terrace.
Ah, so good.
But if you walk outside and your shoes get a little bit dirty when you come in, so in an American house, are there tardigrades like in the carpet?
I think it's possible. Yes. Yeah.
It seems likely, right?
So the mud that actually gets sticks to the shoes are usually wet, but the tardigrades like to get into very dry environments, so they are not likely to get stuck into the shoes so much.
そっか。なんかこう名前とビジュアルで可愛いっていうこう刷り込みがあるので、
動画をね実際にあの動いてるとこ見ていただくと、うん、本当に動きが可愛いんですよ、うん、で、あの節足動物ではないので足が8本あるんですけど、その8本が付け根からこう動くんですよね。でのしのしと動いてる感じがするので、なんかよちよち歩きみたいで非常に可愛いです、
う
ん、
可愛い。
It doesn't seem realYeah. To me, like it doesn't. It seems like things that are that small、mm. are supposed to be. There's no reason for them to look like animals、yeah. that are at our scale.、
Mm.
You know, like the scale is so different、mm-hmm. that why does it have like, why does it look like a bear? Like it should look like one. You know,
なんかムチムチしてるからね。
Something else.
Well, I think it's really.Common for most of the animals to have legs, and if you have, if you see the legs, you kind of feel familiar to you. And the funny thing is that tardigrades also have eyes, although those are not really very functional lenses, but it's only a simple single cell, which is just sticking out as a neuron.
It detects photons.
Just the light, yes. Mm. So it doesn't have a kind of visual perception, but it only detects light.
But it has two eyes.
Two eyes, yes.
So, that's yeah, impressive.
That's yeah. a bit puzzling because they don't actually need a clear vision.
Huh.
What do they eat?
So the ones that we keep, the Macrobiotis shonaicus and the shonai chomemushi, it's both the rotifers, the wamushi, which are also very small animals. I mean, it's not really like animals because they don't have legs, just float around in fresh water. And also they eat algae.
食べ物はじゃあ水の中にいるものを食べる。
そうですね、その環境中にいるものを食べてるんですが、それがあの本当に野外で何を食べてるかは実はまだしっかり分かっていなくてですね、あのおそらく微生物も食べてる、バクテリアも食べてると思うんですけど、僕らが飼育環境ではあのクロレラっていう藻類と、あと、ワムシを使ってます。で、あの、まあ、そうですね。オニクマムシっていうクマムシは肉食系で、完全に線虫とかワムシとか別の生き物を食べるんですね。で、まあ、なので、あの、庄内長命虫もそういうのを与えてみたらワムシを食べたっていうところなんですけど、まあ、この子は雑食で、苔というか、藻類も食べるというものになりますね。
あ、じゃあクマムシの中でも雑食のものと肉食のものがいる。
そうですね、あのクマムシはその門を持っている生き物なので、ものすごく多様性が大きくてですね、海にいるやつなんかっていうのはもう非常に多様な形態を、あの、いや、ちょっと写真とかぜひお見せしたいところなんですけど、
大体何種類ぐらい見つかって
る？今記載されてるのは1200種ぐらいですね。
いや、めっちゃいる。大体このフォルムは同じっていうか似てるんですか？
だいたいこういう、なんというかちょっとずんぐり丸っこい感じで8本足っていうところは基本同じです。で、足の先端に爪があると。ただ、もちろん例外はいろいろとありまして、例えばこちらにお持ちしているトゲクマムシっていうのだと、あのヒゲみたいなのが頭のところに生えてるんですけど、これがあの海のやつだともっとワシャワシャと体中にいろんなところに生えていたり、葉っぱみたいなのが出てたりとか、あるいはフィルムでなんというか、浮き輪みたいなものがついていたりとか、いろんな形態のものがありますね。陸のものはそんなに多様性がなくて、だいたいその庄内長命虫に似たような8本足でずんぐりしているんですが、砂漠にいるようなやつだと、一番後ろの二対の足が失われてて6本足になってて爪だけが残っているとか、そういうちょっと変わったやつもいます。
へ、色はあるんですか？
色はですね、だいたい透明なんですけど、このトゲクマムシだとオレンジ色っぽく見えますし、真っ黄色なやつもいますし、まあ、大抵透明ですね。
クマムシってクマムシを捕食している動物もいるんですか？
います。線虫とかに食べられる時もありますし、おそらく他にもダニとかそういうあの同じ環境に住んでいるもうちょっと大きめな生き物っていうのはクマムシを食べることはあるんだと思います。
繁殖ってどう？
ああ、そうなんです。それはね、非常に面白いところなんですけど、あの乾燥に非常に強いやつらは単位生殖っていって、もうメスしかいなくて、自分のクローンみたいな子供をあのもう自分自身で卵を産むっていうのが、比較的一般的です。ただ、そちらの庄内長命虫、僕が見つけた種ですけど、こちらはあの生殖をします。オスメスがいて、生殖をしないと子供を作れないということになってまして、まあ、実はそれがあの非常にクマムシの生殖っていうのを研究するので、あの結構いいモデルになってですね、最近そういう論文がいくつか、出ています。
オスメスだと見た目は違うとかあります？
慣れて てくるとの違いは言えるんですけど、多分素人の方が見てもわからないと思います。
なるほど、
はい。
Is there any courtship behavior?
Yes. In? Yeah.
Wow.
We actually have the mating behavior kind of video as well. If you want to post it with the podcast, I think.
Yeah,
I can share it later.
Like, how does it look like?
We love posting mating behavior videos.
Yes. So the mating behavior depends on the species. So in this particular case of Macrobiotis, Macrobiotis shonicus, is firstly the male goes up to follow the female and then kind of like touch the genital kind of regions from behind, and then the female eventually twists her body and to expose her genital to the male, and then the male sprays kind of the sperms to to the female, and the sperm swims by into towards the female.
Ah, じゃあリモートなんだ。
そうなんです。これは結構面白くて、その理由も本当に不思議なんですよね。魚とかだと、卵が生まれてそこに精子をかけるっていうケースってのはよくあるんですが、苔の中でそれをやってしまうと拡散してしまうんで、あんまり効率が良くないと思うんですよね。なので、なんでそんなことをあえてするのかっていうのをちょっと不思議なところなんですけど。
へえ、なんでだろう。
It sounds so complete. This animal.
Yes.
You know, like you could have.Nature documentaries like following tardigrades, I feel like.
There were actually some made by BBC, I think, and maybe something from National Geographic.
I bet. その変な話ですけど、オスがその精子をプシュッて出すときに、それはもう穴ってことですか？その出てくる。その例えば男性器みたいに、その突出した何かがついてる。
ショーナイカスの場合は突出してないです。ただし突出しているようなものがあったのも海のに似たような気がしますけど、ちょっとうろ覚えですね。
面白い、すごい不思議。
基本的にはもう今全排出口っていうものになって、卵も精子も肛門としても機能するみたいなものっていうのが、1個あるっていうケースが多いんですけど、
あ、じゃあもう穴1個で全てを済ますみたいな、
はい、
へえへえ。
What does their ecosystem look like in terms of the other animals that they interact with? And
yes, so the ones that live in a very dry environment, the moss undergoes very frequent desiccation, almost complete desiccation, because they're concrete の上とかに生えてる状況なので、まあ乾燥すると完全に干からびてしまうっていう。So all of the animals and other organisms living in the moss must have the desiccation tolerance, including bacteria and the food and everything else. So some very small animals tend to have this kind of desiccation tolerance, like including invertebrates, nematodes, and some of the insects as well. And those, they dry up and as the environment dries, and then they rehydrate as the rain comes in, and the tardigrades just live in with there. But the animals that can go into that kind of state is very limited. So the diversity of the ecosystem itself is very limited in those environments.
Hmm. So when you look at a tardigrade in its typical environment, do you sort of recognize the other animals that show up?
If you look in the microscope, not with your naked eye.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But you can see like, oh, that's this animal. And
oh, yes.
You know, it's kind of like the plains of Africa or something. You know, there's a zebra and a giraffe. And
so it's not that diverse.
Really?
No. So usually the ecosystem is, so the animals that can go into our hardspots is very limited. So it's only usually one species of rotifer, maybe one or two nematodes, and very rarely some insects, and that's about it. And the diversity of bacteria, I've done some barcoding sequencing to identify the bacteria by the sequence level, because it's not really identified by microscopic observation. So under that microscopic, sequence observation, we've only found like tens of that kind of different bacteria, which is very limited compared to other rich environments. If you look into like the wet forest mosses, you identify hundreds or thousands of different bacteria, but they are not possible in dry environment.
その休眠状態っていうのがやっぱすごいところじゃないですか。
そうですね。
クマムシのなんか、その休眠してる間って生きてるのか、 なんかそれどういう状態なんですか。
はい、そこは非常に重要なポイントなんですけど、生きてはいないんですね、うん、まず生きてるかどうかっていうところの定義から考えなきゃいけなくて、まあ、それがそもそもわからないっていうのが僕のこの研究のモチベーションなんですけど、代謝をまず測るということをする、つまり動いてるのかどうかっていうことを判断しようとすると、密封した空間に乾燥したクマムシを入れて、そこで水素とか酸素とかそういったものの変動があるかっていうのを超精密に測ってあげるってことが、まあ、昔から結構やられていて、変動がないっていうことが分かっています、うん、なので基本的に代謝はしていない、代謝は完全に止まっている、つまり、まあ、いわゆる物と同じ状況になっているわけですね、うん、この状況が、生きているかどうかっていうのを、ちょっと言葉を変えて生命活動があるかどうかっていうふうに捉えてしまうと、生命活動はないというふうに言えます。ただ生きているか死んでいるかっていうのが、死ぬっていう状況がですね、生きている活動に、不可逆的な状況であるというふうに考えることができて、もうだから死んじゃったらもう生きて帰ってこれないっていう状況になるとすると、生きて帰ってこれるから、生きているとも言えるわけですね。なので、生きるケイパビリティがある、そして、リビングアクティビティがあるっていう、その二軸で多分考えることができてですね、そうすると生命っていうのは実は、3つか4つの状況に置き換えられるんですね。通常だから生きてるか死んでるかだけの二軸だと生きてる死んでるの二状態なんですけど、生きるケイパビリティがあって動いてる状況と動いてない状況で、生きるケイパビリティがなくて動いてる状況と動いてない状況っていうのが、定義できると。でそのうちの、眠っていて生きるケイパビリティがあるっていう第三の生命状態っていうのが、官民という状況なんじゃないかなというふうに考えています。
なんかそれで今ちょっと私IVF やったので、はい、受精卵を凍結させてるんですけど、うん、それもだから生きるケイパビリティはあるけど、
う
ん、休んでるっていうことですよね。そっか、うん、そのでもパッサパサになっちゃって水を振りかけたらまた復活するっていうのがなんか不思議すぎてあんまりなんか理解できないんですけど。
いや本当にこれは不思議なことです、そもそもですね、その生物学の教科書みたいなものを見るとクマムシ真核生物なんですけど、真核細胞っていうのは細胞膜があって、その中に核があって、核に角膜があって、でミトコンドリアがあって、ミトコンドリアは二重膜があってっていう状況ですよね。でただその膜っていうのが、生体膜って何かっていうと、これリン脂質っていう物質が疎水性結合をしてできているものだというふうに教科書には書いてあるんです、
うん、
つまり油 と、水和する部分とっていうのが2つありまして、まあ、それが水から離れる疎水性をの性質を示すことによって2つの、膜というのが内側が脂質になって外側が、水に制御するところになるということになって、まあ、水があることによって膜ができるというのが定義なんですよ、まあ、そうすると水がなくなったら膜がなくなっちゃって、そうすると細胞がもうそもそもダメになっちゃうだろうというふうに考えられるんですが、まあ、これを守るためのいろんな物質とかっていうのが存在しているというのがクマムシの官民の特徴ですね。
How long have they been around and been able to do this, do you think?Millions and
we actually doing the calculations right now, and we are getting the numbers that they've really went into terrestrialization very early in the history. So the very first plant to go into land happened around. 英語ですぐに数字が出てこないんですけど、だいたい今から4億年前って言ったんですか、400 million years?
Yes.
Yeah. So at that time, the first mosses and algae went into the land. And before then, there was nothing on the land as a living species. And almost as soon as the plant went into terrestrialization, tardigrade seemed to have went into terrestrialization. But that's based on molecular clock calculations. So it's based on the mutation rates of the DNA to estimate the...time, because there's no fossil records of tardigrades and that was old. So,
so you can calculate how many mutations you would have expected to occur over time,
yes.
and then work backwards.
Yes.
面白い。その単一で繁殖する場合、そのクローンみたいな。
はい。
それってその例えばその4億年なりなんかものすごい月日をかけても結局そのまあミューテーションはあるかもしれないけれども。繁殖による進化みたいな
の
はないってことですか？
そうです。メーティングによる組み換えはなくなっちゃうので、そこでの変異というのはなくなるんですが、生殖細胞に入る変異というのは、まあ、他の理由でも入りますので、複製エラーとか、そういう時に、変異というのは蓄積すると思います。ただ、単位生殖するクマムシが地球上に出てきたのは、もうちょっと最近、まあ、最近といっても、 3億年前とかだと思うんですけど、最初の1億年ぐらいは、海にいるやつというのは大体全部性生殖するので、性生殖したものが上がってきて、まあ、次第に単生殖した方が多分有利だったと。つまり乾燥を完全にするような環境に完全に適応してしまうと、乾燥している時にですね、風で飛ばされるんですよ。で、風に飛ばされた時にメイトがいるかどうかっていうのは限らない、そうは限らないので、一人でいた方がそのまま増えることができるので、まあ、次第に単生殖っていうのが生まれていったんだろうというふうに考えてますね。
その寿命とかってどれぐらいなんですか？
寿命は普通に飼ってるとせいぜい半年。
あ、そうなんだ。
まあ、短いやつだと数ヶ月、2、3ヶ月とかで、長いのでも1年、2年ですね。
それはそのずっと生きてる状態の場合ってことですよね。であればですね、はい、で、その乾いたら、その乾いた状態だとどれぐらい？
条件が良ければ無限に半永久的に多分乾燥できるんですよ。で、実際にですね、南極の苔で、まあ、凍結したもの、乾燥して凍結したものっていうのが30年ぐらい経ってから生き返ったっていう例はあります。で、まあ、他の生き物でもですね、そういう乾燥できるものだと8年とか10年とかっていうような記録っていうのはありますので、まあ、結構長くできると思うんですけど、物になっちゃうので、物っていうのはほっとくと風化するんですよ。なので、まあ、乾燥した状況で3年間とか置いとくと、意外とあれぐらいのちっちゃいスケールだとですね、結構しっかり風化するんで、帰ってこれなくなっちゃうことが多いです。
なるほど。なんかこうちょっとした刺激でバラバラになっちゃうとか、そういう、
さすがにそれまではならないんですが、酸化するんですね。まあ、要するに表面が酸素にずっと触れているので、まあ、錆びてしまうというか、
なるほど。
で、まあ、全部がボロボロになるわけじゃないんですけど、まあ、表面だけでもおかしくなってしまったり、あるいは中の DNA が酸化してしまったりとかすると、まあ、生き返ったとしてもその場でちゃんと次のタンパク質を作る命令ができなくて、だんだんと弱っていってしまったりとか、
そっか。だから休眠してる間無敵っていうわけではなくて、その本人のしかもコントロールできない状態ってことですもんね。
そうですね。
あ、ちょっとここ環境悪いから変えようとかができなくなってしまう。
そう、なので生きていれば修復ができるので、常に何か傷があったとしても元に戻るのが生き物なんですけど、物になってしまっていると風化していくということになりますので、まあ、そういう問題があると。で、ただし非常に低温であるとそもそも酸化しにくくなりますし、あるいは真空とかに置いてあげると酸素がないから、酸素がなければ基本的に物はそんなに劣化しないですね。なので、我々も実験室内でそのクマムシを飼って保存するときには冷凍庫に入れておくんですけど、まあ、そうするとほぼ半永久的に持つと思います。
そのクマムシが自分の意思で乾こうってそのなんか例えばクマも冬眠するじゃないですか、あれはもう自分で準備して冬眠するわけですけど、クマムシはそのなんだろう、サーカムスタンス症的にこう休眠に入るわけですか？その自分の意思に関係なく、
クマも意志を持ってやってるかっていうと多分微妙なところで寒くなってくるときっとそういう風になるようにプログラムされてるんでしょうね。で、クマムシもそういう意味ではもっと短いスケールになりますけど、普段ものすごくめちゃめちゃ乾燥する環境にいないようなクマムシって多少準備をしてから乾燥するんですよ。で、そういうようなやつらっていうのは1日とか2日とかかけて準備をしてから乾燥するっていうことになっていて、
まあ、だからどういう準備ですか？
ですね、それはもう体の中で、乾燥するために必要な遺伝子を発現させてタンパクを作って、で、膜を保護する準備とかをするっていう感じですね。
なるほど。
で、ものすごく早く乾燥できるやつらっていうのはそういったものをもう常に体の中に持っていて、でそうすると30分とかでも乾燥ができるっていう状況になっているわけですね。で、まあ、それ以外にも確かにものすごく乾燥するような種っていうのは比較的乾燥する場所を好む傾向があるのかなとは思っていて、なんかやや半乾きみたいな状況にしておくとより乾いていく方に自分で歩いていったりとかします。 あと乾く状況になると突然脱皮始めたり卵を産み始めたりとか、なんかいろんなその準備を多分しているんでしょうね。そういうようなことっていうのはあるようには思いますね。
なるほど、うん、
Do you have a hard materialist view of these things as animals? Do you think of them as like they haveFeelings and experience, or anything like that, or you have a very materialist sort
of. I'm a biologist, so I only think in terms of the workings of the cells and those interactions. But the number of neurons that tadpoles have is in the order of maybe 100 to several hundreds.
Wow.
And majority of those are used in sensing the food that they intake or the light they perceive, and to control the muscles of the legs. So
there's really no possibility that they have emotions of the kind of the kind too.
You have no conflict whatsoever. But it's interesting because, you know, tardigrades have so many characteristics that we refer to when talking about animals and, you know, like courtship behavior and sort of things that humans can relate to in that way. And they're also cute and animal-like, and they have legs and they walk around and they have two eyes, and, you know, so it's, I mean, of course you have this hard materialist view of what these are. You know, I guess essentially it's like a machine.
Yes.
So you analyze it like a machine.
Basically, yes. But まあ飼ってる時にはもうほぼペットをめでるような。
かわいい。
Can people have these as pets, or is that?
It's very difficult to keep them in culture. But if you if you have the love enough to keep them, I think it's possible.
Hmm. Are there people who have them as pets? Do you know any of them?
I'm not sure if you actually call them as pets, but yeah, some people do keep them. So many people are interested in doing research on tardigrades. So many of the, なんて言ったらいいんだ、理科部みたいな高校のサイエンスクラブとかからは、あのサンプル分けてほしいとか、どういうふうに買ったらいいかみたいな質問ってのはよく来ますし、いろいろとその全国で、あの、まあ、アメリカからも来ますね。だからいろんな全世界で、あの高校生とかでクマムシ飼ってる人っていうのはいるし、あのなんかヤフオクで一時期売ってる方もいましたよ。それも普通に多分その辺で取ってきたやつを自分で頑張って飼ってるんだと思いますけど。
なるほど。なんかそのクマムシが生息している感じをあんまり想像できてないからかもしれないんですけど、なんかそのやっぱ休眠がちょっとあまりに気になりすぎて、なんかそのじゃあ半乾きのところにいたら、まあ、自らこう乾く方に行きたいような、
そんなに多分それは本当に実験性変わってるスケールで、実際の環境中では、うん、あの動くといってもですね、もともと彼らすごくちっちゃいので、
うん、
せいぜいその1時間かけても数センチとかしか動かないと思うので
そっかそっか、
あのそんなに動きはしません。で逆にだからこそあの彼らは乾燥するっていう能力を持ってるんですね、うん、つまり僕らみたいに大きな生き物って水がなくなったらあの次の水場まで動けばいいんですよね、まあ、虫とかもそうです。ただクマムシとかああいう生き物って周囲の環境が乾燥するときにその水が乾く速度の方が移動する速度より速いですよ、
うん、
でそうすると水場まで移動することができないからとどまって乾燥するしかない。
そのただ眠りに入ったときと起きたときでその風に吹かれたりとかしてこう起きたときにどこだかこうみたいな感じ、
多分どこだって認識するためにはあのその環境を認知しなきゃいけないから多分その感覚がないです。
なんかどこだと思ってないかもしれないけど、うん、こうなんだろう、すごく過酷な環境に飛ばされちゃってる可能性とかもあるわけですよね、ええ、あでもそっか、でも自分で動ける範囲があまりにもちっちゃいからどっちにしろしょうがないのか。
It probably doesn't have a concept of like position, right? It's just kind of interacting with what's immediately around it.
Yeah.
So it has no idea that it's even been put somewhere else. It's just going to react to the new environment in a predictable way.
Yes.
Yeah, そのスケールが多分ね新しすぎてあんまり想像できてないけど、
It's such a great introduction to this concept of scale and that things are happening on this very small level that you can look at and sort of understand if you have a microscope.
Yes.
But it's like, what are these things doing, you know, here? Like, what is their objective?
So I recommend you look at the tardigrades yourself. I mean, they can be found anywhere around the monsters. So the urban environment is actually very suitable for tardigrades because they're very dry. The concrete surfaces and all those roads are very dry, and it's not really habitable for other organisms, but for tardigrades, it's a perfect environment. So if you go to a parking lot and then there is the car stop block, kuruma dome, and you find tiny mosses that are just dwelling in those corners of those blocks. And if you just pick them up and then put in water for several hours, and then if you look at them under a microscope, you can, there's a high chance that you find a tardigrade.
And Tokyo has a lot of moss.
Yes.
Like way more than anywhere else I've been.
Yeah.
You're like high quality moss is just all over the place.
So you would want to look at a very dirty moss, very dirty, dry moss, not like the beautiful green moss that you find in Kyoto temples.
Yeah, yeah.
But rather a very dirty moss that you find in the corners. It's just stuck in the concrete.
In the sun or in the shade?
In the sun.
Okay.
So in the sun, it's more likely to dry up.
Mm.
So more like wet, humid kind of mosses harbor more of other organisms like nematodes and rotifers, but the dry moss is very likely to harbor tardigrades. Mm. And
how much magnification do you need to?
About 30 times.
That's not very much.
No.
Wait, so if you look at a strand of hair,
yes,
and the tardigrade's next to the strand of hair, like what
so
does that look
the
like?
The strand of hair is still a bit thicker, but not that much. So not like in the order of tens of times of thicker. It's only probably several times thicker.
Really?
Yeah. So we actually sell a tardigrade hunting kit, which is sold by Gakken.
Wow. 欲しい。
ミクロモンスター、なんとかセットみたいなのを売ってて、で、これ毎年夏休み前にものすごく売れるみたいなんですよ。で、やっぱりその自由研究とかでそういうちっちゃな生き物を観察するとかってすごく面白いじゃないですか。で、それにちっちゃな顕微鏡、20倍か30倍か のちっちゃな顕微鏡と、まあ、どういうふうに見つけたらいいかっていうブックレットがセットになって売ってるので、よろしければ。
いや、絶対やりたい、それ。
やる。
やろう。具体的にどういう研究されてるんですか？
いろんなことやってるんですけど、私の基本的なその興味はどうやって冬眠してるのかっていうところのメカニズムなので、今はどういう遺伝子があって、まあ、それがどういうふうに機能することによって乾燥できてるのかっていうことを調べています。で、まあ、私の根本的な興味は応用じゃなくて本当に基礎研究なので、まあ、なんでそういうことが可能なのかっていうところと、あと突き詰めていくと本当にその生きてるっていうのは何なんだろう、生命状態って何なんだろうっていうことをちゃんと定義したいんですよ。で、まあ、それのための研究をしているということですね。ただ同時にいろんなことに興味出てきちゃうんで、だからその新種見つけてみたりとか生殖調べてみたりとか、なんかいろんなそういうサイドワーク的なクマムシ自体はやっぱり愛してしまっているので、まあ、それに対するいろんな興味というもので研究もしていますね。かなり幅広くやってます。
その新種を見つけるときっていうのはそのひたすら苔を集めてくるみたいなことですか？
そうですね。なので私大体もう旅行とか出張とか行くと必ずその場所の苔を集めてくるし、街中も普段、まあ、散歩するときとかにも、まあ、定期的に散歩するルートとかでも定期的に苔を取ってきてで変わってないかとかそういうことを常時まあ、モニタリングしてるというとかっていうんですけど、まあ、趣味でクマムシを見てるおじさんですので、
その急に変わってることもあるんですか？なんかいつもここにいた種類と違ってきてるとか。
そうですね。環境がすごく変わっちゃったりとかするとそういうことが、あり得るので、見てます。で、例えばですね、まあ、街中で見てるときだと、まあ、よく清掃が入るんですよね。
ああ、そうか。
まあ、コンクリートにある苔とかっていうのは、まあ、一見汚らしいので道路をきれいにするとなくなってしまうんですよ。でなくなった後にもう一回またそこに苔が、ま、待ってれば生えるんですけど、でその時に同じ種が戻ってくるかどうかとかそういうようなことっていうのが見れますね。
Do you have a map of where each type of tardigrade is in Tokyo?
So for the Tsuruoka City, I have my private map, which I haven't shown
to anyone. Top
secret
map. Yes.
そっか。クマムシって1回に何匹ぐらい卵を産むんですか？
だいたい8から10ぐらいですかね。まあ、ばらつきは種によって結構ありますけど。
そのうちどれぐらい生き残る感じですか？
それは自然環境下ではわからないですね。実験室内だとほぼ生まれてきますけど、まあ、それは野外だとどうなるかっていうのはわからないですね。
They've sent tardigrades into space,
yes,
and observed that they seem resilient to the effects of space radiation.
Yes.
Do you know why that is?
Yeah, so they've sent the space, they sent tardigrades into space in this anhydrotic state, that dry desiccated state. Mm-hmm. So as just a material, not a living, I mean, there's no living activity. So without metabolism, there's not much to damage the cells in the first place, because water is the main solvent which harbors life. But without water, we're not really perturbated by heat or radiation or anything, because the radiation, the main damage of radiation is indirect. It hits the water molecules and produces hydrogen peroxide or other reactive oxygen species within the water solvent, and then that water solvent, ROS in the water solvent, actually attacks the other molecules. So that is not happening without water.
Right.
So are the radiation is actually passing through the tardigrade in a more harmless way because it doesn't have the water molecules to hit?
That's right. And also, we've identified tardigrade-specific genes, which is only in tardigrades, which protects the DNA molecules as well.
Wow. How does it do that?
So they kind of form a helix to wrap around the DNA.
Hmm.
So anything that's hitting the DNA molecule would hit that protein first. So that protein would be damaged, but the DNA wouldn't.
That's such a straightforward way to protect the DNA. Just build a cover over it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you look at these sort of the molecular machines that are involved in like stripping these like strands of RNA or cell replication or those sorts of?
So far in terms of the protection of the DNA, we've only identified that gene, which we've named the damage suppressor gene.
Mm-hmm.
Much more genes are involved in just protecting the empty space, which is lost as the water is dried out from the cells, or the protecting the surfaces of the membranes or other proteins.
Would it be possible to use that protective gene to maybe create resistance to radiation in other animals?
Yes. So we've exactly done that in the identification of that damage suppressor gene. It's kind of like a mad science, but we put that gene into a human culture cell.
Wow.
And the human culture cells usually dies at the level of 4 gray of radiation, which is equivalent to about 4 sievelts, depending on the radiation source. But the 4 sievelts or the 4 gray of X-ray usually kills the human culture cells. But when we input the damage suppressor from the tardigrade, the culture cell simply proliferates at that level of radiation.
Wow. Were you able to see that the DNA was actually wrapped with this covering?
So not in that human culture cell itself, but we've done that in vitro, meaning we've extracted the DNA and then we've extracted the protein from tardigrades and then mixed them in test tubes and then observed that in the microscope, because it's very difficult to see what's happening within the cell because there are so many other molecules and you cannot really just distinguish the specific protein from the other proteins. So we've done that in a test tube environment, but yes, we can actually see that.
That's crazy. Around.
Wow.
That could be like really important in the future, it seems like.
Well, ethically, we cannot really transport it into humans. So we've only done with the human culture cells. But if you think about space travels in the very long term, so like if you want to travel to Mars, it would take 3 years to go from Earth to Mars and then another 3 years to go back. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's really not suitable kind of to think carrying like 3 years of food in a spaceship. So you would have to do some kind of agriculture within the spaceship. And those spaceships would be very limited in space, so you want to use the space outside of the spaceships. And in that sense, you might want to do a plastic enclosure, which is exported outside the spaceship, and then grow some crops. But those crops will be directly exposed to the space radiation, so they want to be radiation tolerant, and those tardigrades can be used, maybe. But you will have to, fully test if it's okay to eat that thing with that gene and everything else, like if it doesn't cause allergy or anything. But at least that kind of application can be thought of. Yes.
Interesting.
So, I mean, something like that probably wouldn't make us, immune to radiation. But my understanding is that, these are in our bodies when we're in space, it's hitting water molecules and bouncing off and causing oxidative stress to our DNA. So if we can coat our DNA in something and make it more resilient, then the appropriate amount of time you would be able to spend in space without having serious side effects might be longer. I mean, are you human after you do that? But,
yeah, I mean, for humans, I think it's easier to develop a suit, which just shields off the radiation completely. by, I don't know, making a flexible kind of lead kind of products which can shield off the gamma rays.
But in the future, maybe it's easier to do the other thing than to make suits.
I wouldn't really want to pursue the
you're not
human
superhuman.
Yeah, it's not really ethically ethically a good thing to.
You don't think it's a good idea to alter to make germline alterations?
It's a very difficult issue. So, in very specific cases, for like a very critical disease, it might be, but not really. I wouldn't really recommend doing anything else to enhance some abilities or something, because once everyone uses, everyone starts to incorporate that gene into towards like one thing. So if everyone wants to get risk-based, I mean, radiation tolerance or anything, that can be a critical point for the human race if some virus really attacks that gene or something. So in terms of the diversity and issues, I wouldn't really recommend human genetic engineering.
Do you think it will happen anyways?
It could, but I don't know.
Maybe in some other countries.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing, maybe for some diseases, for heritable diseases, where both of the parents have recessive alleles and something. But yeah, that could be discussed in the future, but maybe only that in the kind of situation, not to enhance other abilities.
Well, some doctor in China is going to inject that in one of the twins.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem inevitable that we will eventually live in a world where, you know, some other people have decided that it's worth it to make those kinds of changes. And I don't know how we map the phylogeny of humans or how... You know, are these Homo sapiens something now, or, you know, and then...
So I don't think it really directly differentiates the species of the humankind, because the speciation is only happening in terms of organism of our level by sexual reproduction. So if it doesn't change the way we sexually reproduce, even at the gamete stage... I don't think it really makes a speciation of humankind.
It's just a different version.
It's different humans.
Of humans. So, もともとその最初からクマムシの研究されてたんですか？
いや、違いますね。もともとはかなりコンピューター寄りの仕事をしてまして、細胞のシミュレーションとかそういうことをやってたんですよ。で、もうほとんど実験もしないで、その細胞の中のですね化学反応を、まあ、一個一個微分方程式でモデルして、で、まあ、今そのゲノムが読めるようになってきてるんで、どういう遺伝子があるか分かるんですね。で、遺伝子が分かると、まあ、酵素が分かるんで、その酵素の反応を一個一個モデルしてあげると、例えば微生物であれば遺伝子の数って4000個ぐらいしかないので、4000個の反応式を、まあ、全部書くことができれば、その生物の動きというのを再現することができるので、まあ、そういうことをやってたんですけど、なんかコンピューターでそれをやればやるほどですね、どこまで作ったら生きてるって言えるんだろうっていうのが分かんなくなっちゃったんですよ。で、それっぽいリアリスティックなものは作れるんですね。実際なんか 3D で当時 Wii が、ニンテンドの Wii があったので、 Wii リモコンでこうくるくる動かせるようなモデリングとかもしてたんですけど、まあ、そうすると見た目的には生きてるように見えるんです。ふわふわしてて代謝もするし、で、だけど何が生きてるかっていうことを実は僕ら誰も定義できてないですね。で、生物学って本当はそういう意味ですごく危うい学問で、他の自然科学って物理とか化学とかって、物理が何かって定義できるんですよ。で、化学のその化学反応が何かってことは全部定義できるんですけど、生物って生物が何かって定義できないから、まあ、地球外に行った時に何かそこに生命体がいたとして、今の生物学って多分何もそこに適応できないんですよね。今の生物学って全部その DNA があるもので、それがタンパク質になってどうなるかってことを全部研究しているので、だからコンピューターで何か作った時にそれが生命かどうかって僕らを理解する術がないと思ったので、それをじゃあ理解できるものをちゃんと調べたいなというふうに思ったんです。で、まあ、当時はそのクマムシを知らなかったんで、なんかゾンビとかいたらいいなとか思っ てゾンビって死んで生き返って掘れるじゃないですか。まあ、なのでそういうような生き物がいたらいいなと思って、テレビ見てたらクマムシが出てきて、で、そこからもうこれしかないと思って研究テーマ変えましたね。で、
すごい。
最初は本当結構大変でしたけど、そもそも飼えなかったので。
Do you know the rumor about Walt Disney?
He's frozen.
There's a rumor. Supposedly Walt Disney is frozen underneath Disney World.
Yes.
If they were able to revive him, how would that? What would you think about humans being alive? Would you give them the same? Humans would have the same definition as tardigrades, more or less. We can sort of go into this. Like, is Walt Disney dead under Disney World, or is he just hibernating? Let's say they're successful.
Yes, so, yeah, if there's enough medical technology that can revive him from the dead, and then also cure the disease that he had, he could just be considered as a dormant state, the hibernated state.
Mm. So we don't actually know whether he's dead or not yet.
Medically, he's dead.
Well, medically, he's dead. But scientifically, do we not know whether he's...
So the definition of death itself is also very difficult. So in old Japanese medical terms, we had the term kyūshi. Kyūshi ni shōeru っていうのを、kyūshi っていうのがあって、その、this was in the Edo period, I guess. The death was considered 9 different processes. So first, the heart stops. But your body cells are still active in them. Mm-hmm. So sometimes hair still grows, even if you are dead and the heart is not functioning. And then you eventually get decomposed, and then you eventually going, just the bone will remain. And the people in that area divided the human death as 9 different stages. So the death of the individual happens as soon as your respiratory system stops. But... the body cells would still be active for another several hours or times. And then, so the timing of death is also very difficult to decide.
It doesn't going to sleep take you a few stages into death?
No, I don't think so. It's just the lack of the cognitive perception, and your body is totally functional.
So the body is functional.
So yeah, another concept of brain death is another thing. So you can sustain the activity of your body or the homeostasis of your body if you use それはなんて言ったらいいんでしょうか。あのまあそういう生命維持装置があれば、まあ脳死になっても体自体は活動を続けることができるわけですよね。でもそれをだから死とするかどうかっていうのはずっと議論があって、法律的にはそうするっていうふうに決めたわけですよね。だからあれが死なのかどうかっていう問題なので、それはもうあの生物学的な問題じゃないんですよ。法律的な問題なんですよね。だからウォルト・ディズニーが死んでるかどうかっていうのも多分生物学的な問題じゃない。だからあれがもし本当に完全にまあそれも疑わしいですけど、完全に本当にあの生きた状況から瞬間的に凍結できたとすると、溶かしたときにまだ多分細胞は数時間動く可能性がありますね。でも、まあ、だからそれを生とするのか死とするのかっていうのは、多分その時の、技術とか倫理観とか法律に従って決められることだと思うので、だから今その、まあ、心臓が止まって、まあ、五輪中ですというふうにこう医者が判断したときに死ぬっていうことになってますので、まあ、それまでは死んでないわけですね。医者が判断するまでは死んでないことになってる。
Like, what's the truth? You know, like what? Because you could take your brain completely out of your head and then replace it with some device that sent the appropriate electrical impulses to make everything keep working. Are you alive?
So I guess with humans, it's different, right? Because you have consciousness, and so when you're like, 脳死とかもそうですけど、例えば、even if your body's totally alive, if you're completely, if your consciousness is gone and it's irreversible, like it's never coming back, then we tend to think that that's basically death, right? But when in terms of like kumamushi toka, like other animals, I guess that's a different story, right? Because
kumamushi でも多分同じで、戻ってこれないっていうのが死に至る状況。だからどこかでその point of irreversibility のところがあって、戻ってこない境界があって、
right.
でそれがあの生命体として代謝を維持するために必要なのかどうかっていうのが多分動物の
問題ですね。で、人間の場合には多分そこに意識も入ってくる
ん
だと思います。ただ何がリバーシブルかどうかっていうのはその時のテクノロジーによって決まるんですよ。だからまあ、昔だったら結核とかでもう、まあ、普通にみんな死んじゃってたわけですけど、今は抗生物質があればそれは治るわけですよね。だから今だと、まあ、コロナとかでもそういうことになってますけど、まあ、近いうちにそういうの薬が、まあ、見つかってくれば、まあ、リバーシブルになってくると、だからその時の僕らが持っているテクノロジーによって、決まるっていうのが多分人間のリバーシビリティの難しいところなんですよね。でもクマムシが戻ってこれか来れないかはこれはもうかなり部品も限られているので多分バシッと決まることができると思うんですね。なのでそれはきちんと定義したいと思います。つまりどれだけ体の、インテグリティが壊れた時に戻ってこれなくなるのかっていうのは定量化できるはずだと僕は思っていて、
それを研究されてる。
それは究極的にはしたいですね。そのするためにはまずどういう部品で動いてるかということを理解しなきゃいけないので、今はまだそれをやってる段階です、
なるほど、なるほど。
Some people think that all human beings will be like resurrected in the distant future. All the information, this might be, I think this is interesting, but all the information in the universe is, it's put into its environment. It's preserved in some way, right?Anytime, even me talking right now, the vibrations, the information changes things, and it's preserved in some way. So theoretically, in the distant future, a sufficiently advanced AI could reconstruct people based on the information that they imparted into the world while they were alive. Now, this could be, I don't know, AI a million years from now or whatever it is, but there's this idea that everything that we're doing will be like we will make heaven ourselves with some descendant AI in the future or something.
So there are two different possibilities. So the one external reconstruction that you just talked about. So based on the information of outside to build the model of inside. And another possible way is to just reconstruct the entire structure of your brain. And then if you just, transport it into some computer software, that reconstruction of brain itself should function as what we think we are functioning. So,
do you think continuity matters? So like, is it just where the atoms are, or does it matter? Does continuity matter? So is it just the position of each atom that matters, or does it matter how it showed up?
どこでもドア問題, right?
Like, yeah, like,
あれをくぐった瞬間に、まあ、アトムの配置とかは全部一緒だけど、まあ、違う。
Yeah. So if continuity mattered, then it wouldn't really be you.But if it doesn't matter, then it is you.
But are you you every morning when you wake up?
Because
the continuity is lost.
I perceive continuity because I have memory. Mm-hmm. So I, as far as I can tell, I'm me.
So if you take the position that the memory is the essential thing that binds the continuity, you will be the same continuous thing if you just reconstruct everything from the atoms. Because the memory would be stored in the structure of the neurons.
But you kind of need to remember that you were reconstructed too.
Do you?
I don't know.
So, let's say sometimes, like once in 10 years, you dreaming in a dream.
Yeah.
And when you wake up, you kind of feel funny because you thought you were dreaming in a dream and then you just woke up and then am I in a dream?
Well, I haven't ruled that out yet, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of like the movie Inception thing. So in that case, your continuity in the memory is lost for some very short period of time until you kind of recover yourself and, get back to your normal feeling.
But if continuity matters, then that person who remembers that they're me is not really me. It's only fooling that person, right? The real me depends on continuity. At least that's how it feels.
It is a bit.
That's what the real me is, right?
Include other psychological disorders too, because なんですか、まあ、多重人格とか、まあ、そういうようなケースがあったときに、まあ、コンティニューティーなくなってるわけですよね、その人の個性の間で。でもその時にその個体としてのその人が変わってるのかというと、そうとも言えないと思うので、
まあ、なかなかあの何をベースにコンティニューティーを考えるかっていうのは結構難しい、うん、だそれも多分法律の世界になってくるんだと思いますね、最終的には、
うん、
だから社会として多重人格の人に2つの、人権というかあの、まあ、戸籍上の席を与えるってことも、まあ、やろうと思えばできると思いますし、でもそうしなくて、まあ、あの今だと保険証は1個になるわけですよねとか、そういうのは、うん、僕らが決めることじゃなくて社会が合意として決めること。
Right. I mean, it's a philosophical question, right? Like tardigrade too. I mean, after 30 years of being dried up, then you sprinkle water and it's
but it's alive the same,
now. But is it the same? Is it exactly the same?
The same? I don't know why it's such a hang-up for me, like personally, like the continuity thing. Is it's like.Like me as a person right now, I feel like there's sort of a natural tracing you can do of my atoms all the way back to the Big Bang. And I wasn't copied at some point. And there's like a fundamental difference between me and then a person who was a copy. Because the fact that they're the second version of it is different information, I feel like, fundamentally about...the person, like the continuity is information that changes what the original thing or what that thing is. Does that make sense?
So in the case where we can have a perfect copy of the neurons, and then if you just copy yourself into two different versions, with a machine body or something, then
I would look at that person and say, that's not me.
But that person would also say to you that you're not you.
And we're both right,
yes.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's both you.
Yeah.
We'll never know until that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then that's a question of like definitive reality, right? Like, I mean, everyone is in your own reality.
Yeah, and the continuity issue, I mean, it comes up because of this defining life issue. But yeah, like you were saying, how do you know you don't wake up tomorrow as a different person? You know, like you could actually, you know, we could all just be waking up every day as like a different person, like a different human or whatever. But as long as we have the memories and everything, it's, you know, what is waking up?
So everything gets very...difficult if you talk about the continuity of the mind or the continuity of just the life itself. Mm-hmm. So the functioning of the body or the whatever it is coded in the genome is very simple. So if you look into animals which don't have a mind, it's much more simpler to define in the physical terms what are they living state and what is not. Mm-hmm. But if you... going to the cognitive state, you really have to have a consensus as a cognitive minds of the society to define what is the cognitive self and what the cognitive continuity is.
Do you think that's sort of, are we making progress there, or there's not much progress to be made in that area? Or
it is still considered impossible to reconstruct everything of the brain into an AI or some other models, so it would take some more time, probably several more centuries.
How about the question of what is alive, and are we, you know, are we alive, do we have consciousness or free will? Like, what is your stance on free will, I guess, would be?
For humans?
Is it possible for any creature of this universe to...
I think it is possible. I feel like I have a free will.
Do you think you have free will, or you're kind of made to believe that you have
So there is a free will. Limit to my free will based on the structure of my brain and the structure of my body. But... still within that scope, you know, I still have a free will.
And would a tardigrade, like, it gets some stimulus from this eyeball and then, you know, over here, and is it making decisions, or it's so mechanical that it's not...
Usually tardigrades walk away from light. Mm. Because where the light is, it's a lot more likely to be desiccated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
But sometimes tardigrades tend to like to go to the dried state. So in that case, they probably walk twice light.
Mm.
Is that free will or it's just a reaction? It's just a reaction,
yes.
Mm.
So there are only 100 neurons, several hundred neurons. Mm. And majority of them were used to pulse the mechanical activities of the legs and the muscles.
Mm.
So, what can you do with a circuit of about 50 yes or no switches?
Hmm.
So you think we have free will, and I think we have free will too. I don't know if I have a choice about that, but I do. but I would love to hear like why you think that. Like,
because the outcome of the network is unpredictable.
Is it unpredictable to us or just?
So even if we use any kind of computers, like the supercomputers, so the fastest supercomputers we have in the world, we cannot really simulate what's happening in the neurons.
Mm.
So it is at least not possible to determine what everyone is thinking in the current technology. So even if you really think about the future technologies, there is this limit of the speed of light, so it's really not that feasible to do a simulation of your mind faster than what you think. So I don't think it's really predictable in any ways in the current laws of physics.
But if you could put what your mind is physically entirely into a simulation, would the simulation mind think the same things that you're going to think from that point on? Or would they diverge?
It would diverge if you have different morphology. So I think the perception that we have is really confined by the structure of our body and the structure of our... Perceptions, maybe? So if they're put into... different way. So only the brain network is transported into computers. They are not really percepting the outer environment as we do. Mm. And that will really change what they would really think and react. And how the neurons react is very dependent on what we get input from our, like, sound from the ears and the vision from the eyes or the body senses. So that will really change it, change how you feel.
I'm worried that our perception of free will is simply a limit of our measurements, and that in the future, an artificial intelligence would be able to predict the next word that I would be planning to say. And so
I'm sure there are many cases where it's predictable. So, for example, if you go to Amazon, there's people who are buying this would also want this. That's kind of predictable, you know? So it's
but at a certain if that only gets better and it keeps getting better and there's no reason for it to stop getting better at predicting what we're going to say or think, it seems like eventually the artificial intelligence will just know exactly what I'm about to say and there's not going to be any point for me to even talk anymore. Like, I don't even
there are some spontaneous reactions which is kind of out of context, which could be defined by external stimuli, but that would require sensing everything that's surrounding you and knowing how your senses are functioning. So that would be should be a limit as to how much we can really predict from the outer environment, and so something would still remain as spontaneous.
But the question is if. It's like a thought experiment, right? It's like if there was no limit in measurement.
Mm-hmm.
There is. There's a physical limit because there's a physical limit of speed of light.
Mm. So it will never get there to the point where we actually have to start questioning if we have free will or not.
So in terms of physics, it is not possible to define the state of or the location of the electrons around the atoms. When you so it's a Schrodinger's cat problem. When you observe it, the position is only defined at the point, and the all of the probability of the position of the electron is just there as a probability and not as a defined state.
Mm-hmm.
So it is impossible physically to know the entire state of your atoms of your brain at the same time. So because when you observe one point, that would change mm-hmm. other points. So it's basically impossible to simulate everything.
Right. I don't know if we would have to come close to that limit, though, in order to predict human behavior enough to make us extremely uncomfortable.
Obviously, there are predictable things. Like, so, you know, when you text someone, the iPhone knows what word you want to use next. And then there are, you know, frequent... So I want to go somewhere, and then the location would be... very close to what you want to intend. And
but there are certain animals like C. elegans or I guess the tardigrade that have been studied so much, and I don't know to what extent the animal has been modeled like in a simulation.
So simulation of tardigrades and nematodes are very easy because they only have several hundred million neurons. But if you go into insects, they have up to like 10,000 maybe, tens of thousands of neurons. That is quite unpredictable even at the current level of computing.
So the behavior of these 100 level neuron animals is quite easy for us to predict?
I think so, yes.
That's pretty crazy. And so in the future...
only have 1,000 cells in total. So it's a very simple system.
And they don't divide the cells, right? They persist?
Some of the cells do divide. So the cells around the gut keeps dividing, and the reproductive cells obviously divide.
Wow.
But the basic neuron structures and the muscle structures do not divide.
So how are they... Are you personally involved in modeling the organism in a simulation or in a computer?
So I used to do the simulation for the bacterial cells, but I think what we can do in the next several decades is at the level of bacteria is probably the maximum, and not really possible to model eukaryotic cells because it's much more complex. It has a lot of mitochondria in it, which are individually like bacterial cells. So I would like to do science as I can finish within my life terms.
Yeah.
So right. I will only pursue as much as the simulation of bacterial cells
for my interest. So much of that process is making these mysterias explicit, you know, that we can define what is happening.
Yes.
And I've been very impressed with what scientists have been able to do with molecules, sort of the DNA size. You know, they have all these computer models of all kinds of molecular machines that like walk along. It has legs. There are things that have legs and like walk
the actins along. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you played Minecraft?
Yes.
Couldn't someone make a Minecraft that was at the molecular level and make it completely accurate? Or is that not...
So the current atomic simulation, accurate molecular dynamic simulations of the atomic scale, like molding of the proteins, is only possible for several proteins at maybe up to picoseconds or nanoseconds maybe at maximum. So in the scale of the Minecraft, it wouldn't be possible.
Can you explain exactly why that wouldn't be possible?
Because accurate simulation requires the solving the Schrödinger's equations and everything else, and the calculation that simply is really difficult.
So it's not as simple as, you know, in chemistry class you have like you just stick in a ball, stick, and then here's the molecular structure. But when you talk about the interactions and stuff, it's far more complex.
Yes. So even a single molecule of the DNA contains how many atoms? Tens of atoms. And if you want to model a DNA, that would contain at the very small level, like the RNA would contain 1,000 nucleotides. And there are water surrounding, and the water molecules are just dense surrounding everything else. And you have to model that in 3D motion and everything. And that
Can you ignore the atomic level, or is that not feasible?
If you want to be accurate, you have to be in the atomic level. Otherwise, the hydrophobic, I mean, 水素結合, hydrogen bonds, cannot be, or the van der Waals energy cannot be calculated.
I was thinking if there was some approximate version of this that could be created at a molecular level.
So if it
could be a lot of fun and educational for kids.
Yes, but it's not accurate. So
yeah,
you cannot really call it a simulation. You can call it an animation. And a game. Animation can be made. Yes.
そっか。あの、雲の糸の研究もされてるんですよね。
そうですね。
それはどういう。
はい。ね、雲の糸もちょっと持ってきてるんですけど。
Spider webs. Wow. Spider Man.
そう、あの、あ。ですね。雲の糸の研究自体は、比較的、一見応用寄りの話をしていて、我々の研究所は山形県鶴岡市に先端生命科学研究所というところであるんですけど、そこから、僕らの後輩がスパイバーっていう会社を作って、今スピンオフでベンチャーやってるんですよ。でそれ何やってるかというと、雲の糸を人工的に合成して、微生物で作らせてですね、でそこから、再生可能な、まあ、繊維を作るっていうようなとか、そういう素材を作るっていうことをやってるんですね。で、まあ、雲の糸ってものすごく強いので、鉄よりも強くて、まあ、ちょっと直感に反するんですけど、で、あと伸びるっていう性質があってですね、普通、あらゆる地球上のものって、伸びるか硬いかのどっちかなんです。で、まあ、例えばこういう木とか鉄とか、こういう、鉱物、セラミックですねとかっていうのは硬いけど伸びない。で一方でゴムとか、まあ、こういうナイロンとかそういうものとかっていうのは伸びるけど強くないっていうものがあって、で伸びて強いっていうのは基本的にあんま地球上で人類が使っているものとしては存在してないですよね。でもそれは衝撃が吸収できて、かつ、強いっていうことにもなるので、結構いろんな応用が考えられて、でしかも今繊維っていうのはほとんどとか、まあ、繊維に限らずプラスチックっていうのは石油から作ってるので、まあ、地面から掘ったものを、使ってるわけですけど、サステイナブルじゃないものですよね。でそれを再生可能にできるっていうところで、雲の糸っていうのが、まあ、注目されてる、ところなんです、ね。
鉄よりも強いんですか？
鉄より強いです。でこれ直感に反するんですけど、よく、森の中とか歩いて雲の糸に引っかかったりとかすると、まあ、簡単に手で振り払えば切れるんで、まあ、鉄より弱そうに見えるんですけど、雲の糸ってすごく繊細で、直径10ミクロンもないんですね。数ミクロンしかない。で、数ミクロンの針金をもし作ったらっていうふうに考えると、多分プチって切れるだろうなって想像つくと思うんですけど、でだからその単位面積というか密度あたりにしてあげると、雲糸の方が強いですね。
すごい、考えたことなかった。
And how can theyAre they going to manufacture the silk? Without spiders?
Without spiders. So it's very difficult to keep spiders in culture because they need territory to make the old webs. And they tend to eat each other if they are too dense. So it's really not feasible to keep a lot of spiders to produce silks. So we input the spider silk protein gene into bacteria.And then use bacterial fermentation, just like making alcohol or other things, to produce the spider silk proteins. And we extract them from the bacteria, and then we make it into threads.
How do you make the proteins into the thread?
So the protein itself has some functionality to form microfibrils. And then so in the industrial scale, it's not what's happening in the biological scale, but in industrial scale, you dissolve the proteins in a dope, and then you put it into a solidifying dope. You can make it into a thread. So if you put the pressure and then spray in kind of like a beam kind of setting, as they solidify, they form into a thread.
Is this a chemical process or a mechanical process?
It's both mechanical and chemical. So the protein itself has a bonding potential to interact molecularly to make fibers. But we or at least in the industrial scale in the spiber company, they are making a chemical process to enhance that bond forming.
Which spider has been chosen for this?
So initially, the spider silk was only available for European garden spider species. Niwaonigumo っていう日本語だと北海道とかにはいる雲なんですけど、それしかですね。オニグモ結構ねいるんですけど、今の季節ちょっといないかな。よく家の外とかでも、あの、まあ、この高さだといまいかもしれませんけど。
わあすごい。はあ。
綺麗な雲ですね。
わあ。
大きそうな。
ただあのもうその配列からはだいぶ変わってます。つまりそれをあの微生物に入れられるようにすることだったりとか、あるいは生産性を良くしたりとか、あるいはあの強度を変えるためにもやっぱりちょっと配列をいじったりとかしますので、まあ、そうするとそれをベースにはしてるんだけども、まあ、少しずつ変わってるっていうものになります、ね。で当時あのそのスパイバーが会社を作った時にはそのニワゴニグモの配列しかなかったので、それを使ってるんですけど、僕がその後に、選手クモ の, あの配列を読みましたので今、もうありとあらゆるクモの配列があります、で、まあ、クモによってはものすごく強い糸を作るものからあのものすごく伸びる糸を作るものとかいろんなその環境に適応したものがいるので、まあ、そういったものをソースにいろんな素材を作れるっていうのがまあ楽しい。
それを混ぜることもできるんです
か？混ぜることもできると思いますけど、僕があのなんでこの仕事をそもそも始めたかっていうと、あんまり、あのさっきも言ったように僕は応用興味なくて基礎研究に興味があるんですよ、であのそのシミュレーションやった時にゲノムの情報を入れてシミュレーションをするってことをやってたんですけど、それは結局ゲノムの中にどういう遺伝子があるかっていう情報からやってただけで、遺伝子の中の例えば配列の DNA の1文字を変えた時にどうなるかってことっていうのはシミュレーションできてなかったんですよね。それにずっとフラストレーションがあって、ゲノムを解読した解読したみたいなことをよくニュースとかで言って、なんか、あのヒューマンゲノムディコーデみたいなこと言うんですけど、あのディコードする解読するっていうことは中のことをちゃんと分かってますよね。1文字1文字の意味が分かって初めて多分解読っていうと思うんですけど、それができてないことにすごいフラストレーションがあって、だからちゃんと1文字変えた時に何が起きるかっていうことを定量的に示したいなとずっと思ってたんです。でその時にその雲の話をまあ、後輩たちと一緒にしててですね、でそうするとあれはもう物として糸ができてくるから物性が測りやすいんですよね、あの酵素とかだと酵素反応でインタラクションがどうやっていうのは結構大変なんですけど、まあ、雲の糸として強さがどうだ伸び率がどうだってことが簡単に定量できる、でこれは全部タンパク質でできてるから、それを一文字変えた時にどうなるかっていうことっていうのは非常にそのリンクがしやすいし、しかも世界中のそのいろんな雲がいろんな糸を作るから、それをとりあえず片っ端から集めてくると法則が見えるだろうと。つまり進化って少しずつ変わっていくので、あの進化の系統を見ていくと雲がだんだんとこう強くなる系統になっているグループっていうのをまあ見出すことができるわけですね。その中のアミノ酸の変化と物性の変化を追っていくと、このアミノ酸が変わっていくとどんどん強くなってるよねっていうことがあの統計解析でできるんですよね。でそしたら今度その知見をフィードバックして、スパイバーに実際にじゃあこういう文字書いて作ってみてよっていうふうにお願いして、であのそこからできたプロダクトっていうのが、まあ、本当にその予想通りになったかどうかっていうことで、ちゃんとデコードして理解するっていうことが少なくとも雲の糸に関してはできるかなと思ってやってます。
その雲にとってはどういう意図が理想というか、その強ければ強ければ強ければ強いほどいいのか、そういうわけでもないのか。
あ、全然そうではないですし、そもそも雲自体、7種類ぐらい糸使い分けてるので、
あ、1人の雲というか1種類の雲、
ね、あの、まあ、雲も本当に幅広くて地球上に4万5000種ぐらいいるので、まあ、そのうちの、いわゆる僕らが見る炎毛を張るやつ、網を張ってるやつっていうのは大体7種類ぐらい使い分けてます、で、普段ぶら下がって移動してる時の糸っていうのがありますよね。あれが、まあ、スパイダーマンが出してるやつ、あれ多分、はい、あれが牽引糸っていう糸で最も強い糸ですね。自分の自重をテコの原理で支えてるので、まあ、ものすごく強くてしかも伸びる必要があるんです。であれが網を作る時の枠になってる糸なんですね。でも網の獲物を捕まえる糸っていうのは、虫が飛んできた時にその衝撃を吸収する必要があるから強さよりも伸びが必要なんです。伸びるということはその衝撃を吸収できるの で,、でなので、横糸というのはすごく伸びる糸になっているんです、で横糸の他に雲が歩く枠糸 の, あのスパイラルになっているものがあって、これはあのもうちょっと強いであんまり縮まない糸になっています。自分が歩く足場なので、縮んでくれちゃ困るっていうわけですね。でそれ以外にもですね、獲物が飛んできた時に
くるくるってくるんで動けなくするような糸、まあ、これは比較的強くて伸びる糸だったりとか、ネバネバしてですね、虫をくっつけるための糸みたいなのもあって、でそういうようなものも別の糸として存在し、あと卵を守る糸とか、
うーん、
でこれが全部もともと同じ遺伝子から進化してる。
へえ、その一人のクモが同じ穴、あれ穴から出してるんですか。
お尻のところに糸を出す、糸イボっていうんですけど、うん、が存在してて、それが糸ごとに、あります。
あ、穴が、
そうですね、はい、
あ、じゃあ7種類だったら7個穴が、
実はもっとあるんですけど、左右から1本ずつ出したりとかするのもあるので、ペアになってるものもあるし、あるいは、うん、網状にですね、なんか不織布みたいにブワッとこう出すような糸もあって、それはたくさん穴が開いてたりとか。
へえ、全然知らなかった。なんか1本だけだと思って。
お尻のとこ拡大すると穴がすごいたくさんあります。穴というか突起なんですよね。糸イボという、その糸を出す、イボみたいなのが、まあ、非常にもう顕微鏡で見るようなスケールなんですけど、たくさんあります。
へえ、じゃあそのネバネバのやつはこの穴からとかって決まってる、
ね、決まってます。
穴というか突起からって決まってる。全然知らなかった。That's crazy.
Spiders are, they're so creepy. They, you know, they have so many eyes and the,、mm-hmm. the like what they've decided to do,、mm-hmm. which is like hang out between stuff, like in the air,、
mm-hmm.
is like so, it's so unique and like、yeah. it all comes down to like this web.
Yes.
Like it's not technology, but tool,、
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah, they're very successful predators. And since many of the insects fly, it's、mm-hmm. very reasonable to have a trap in the open airspace. And、mm-hmm. their vision is really optimized to look at many moving targets in the same place. So many spiders have 8 different eyes.、
Mm-hmm.
I saw what I believe was, it looked like a metal spider. I don't know if it was metal. But when I was in...I was in Tohoku, and I was doing some relief work in the mountains, and they have crazy looking spiders and stuff in Tohoku that I've never seen in Shizuoka or over here. But there was this one like gold silver spider with a skull on its back. I mean, it looked exactly like a skull. I have a picture of this thing somewhere, but it was so crazy looking. I called over these other volunteers I was with. We had a group of like 15 people looking at this one spider. And we're all like, oh my God, it looks so crazy.
Yeah, there are amazing different types of spiders. But diversity of spiders are more diverse in the warmer regions, so around the equator.
Mm.
So there are much more diversity in Okinawa, so...The diversity in Tohoku area wouldn't be that much, but so it might be very special.
It's a weird question, but like, なんかその体調不良の時に糸が出にくくなるとか、なんかそういうことってあるんですか？
糸は本当にクモにとっては重要で、まあクモっていうのは全部糸を作るんですけど、糸がないと本当に移動も生活も食べることもできないことになってしまうので、飢餓状態でも糸はちゃんと出せます。で、多少やっぱり弱ったりとかはするんですけど、糸を出すことっていうのはもう生命線の一つなので、そんなに性質としては落ちないですね。まあもうあれがなくなるってことは死を意味するので、最後まで作ってると思います。で、やっぱりクモって体のほとんどが腹部、お腹のとこですね。お腹とか一番大きくて、で頭のとこすごいちっちゃいですけど、お腹の中ほとんどもう糸を作る臓器なんですよ。だからもうそれぐらい糸を作ることに特化してる生き物になりますね。
そっか。
Do they have a different web? I don't know if all spiders do this, but when I was a kid, I was living in Austin, Texas, and there were these spiders that would lay like a sack, like this a bag. And there was this like little white bag on the wooden gate to go into the yard.
Mm.
I'm like, what is that? And I like poked with something and just thousands of little spiders came out and just started going all over the place.
Yeah, it's an egg and, sack.
Yeah. Yes. So is that all spiders are creating egg sacks like that?
Yeah, majority of spiders create egg sacks.
And is that a yet another special kind of...silk or
yes, egg sac silks are two kinds.
And wow. So they have the inner hard layer and the outer soft layer to fully protect the eggs.
Wow.
And there's so many. Do you know how many baby spiders are
there? Hundreds to even thousands, maybe, in some species.
Oh, man.
They produce so many offsprings.
Is the survival rate, like, extremely low?
Or? Yes. So they predate on each other. And sometimes in the very hot conditions, parents even eat the kids. So,
I see. Because when I was a kid, I didn't know that the survival rate was low. So when this thing hatched, I'm like, in like a few days, like everywhere is going to be spiders. Yeah. Like, you know, like you know, like this whole the whole house, right. Everything. Because you imagine them full size. Every it's like that's a lot.
Yeah, a lot of insects also take that kind of strategy. Like mantis tend to have very large number of offsprings.
Mm. Mm. Frogs too. No, like I was at the park the other day, and the pond was full of tadpoles. And the park is not that big, so I was telling my husband, like, hey, こんな生まれたらもうカエルだらけになるじゃんって言ったら, he was like, no, the survival rate is really low, so.
Yeah. I think, like, fish also produce a lot of eggs. Like
turtles?
Ikura, some
like. Like the sea turtles do that too, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so, I was kind of surprised when you said that tardigrades only produce, you know, like 10 or less offspring. Because, you know, you see some of these other animals, like jellyfish are like, jellyfish make jellyfish, which, make, you know, they make those, what are those things called? They attach to the coral or whatever.
The polyps.
Yeah, the polyps. Yeah. And then there's like tons of polyps, and the polyps create like these stacked chains of like hundreds of jellyfish.
Yeah, so... Those survival strategies to make a lot of offsprings is in the case where there are many predators. The predators prey on the newborns, and then in order to survive, you have to produce a lot of offsprings. But in the tardigrade habitats, there are not really many predators because larger animals cannot survive complete desiccation. So tardigrade only lives in an environment where only tardigrades are proliferating. So there are... lack of a very large number of offsprings is balanced by the lack of predators.
With spiders, there are so many, I mean, thousands of babies all at once. And that's why they eat each other, or they had to have so many babies because they tend to eat each other, or... It's like
Well, there are also predators of spiders too. So, in order to have a surviving offspring, you have to have a large number of them. So, it's not only on the predation on themselves.
It's kind of weird that they eat each other.
I guess you can afford to if you have that many.
I guess
offspring. You know, use some of them. You saw that? Supposedly, there are tardigrades on the lunar surface now.
The Israeli the spaceship.
Was it Bereshit? Is that the one? Crashed into the crash landed on the moon, and they believe that there were. Well, they know that they had included some tardigrades on there,
but they don't specify which species it was.
Mm. What do you make of this whole thing?
Well, I think the species they carry was Hypsibius, because otherwise it's very difficult to culture in large numbers, and the only tardigrade that you can purchase is Hypsibius exemplaris, which does not have very strong desiccation tolerance. And those tardigrades is probably dead in the very early days. And the lunar surface is quite a harsh condition. So the temperature goes up to... I forgot the exact number, but probably up to like 120 or 160 degrees Celsius in the daytime, because there's no atmosphere to shield off the sun, right? And in the nighttime, it goes down to several negative degrees Celsius. So that temperature change alone can kill the tardigrades, because tardigrades are tolerant to high temperatures, but not as high as 100 degrees Celsius.
な何度ぐらいまでだったら大丈夫なんですか？1回だけだったら多分100度ギリギリ15分ぐらい。へえ。
So you can microwave the tardigrades for 5 minutes, but if you do it for 10 minutes, they wouldn't survive. So that's around.
You can microwave them, and they can still come back. That's insane.
If they're dry,
yes,
right.
Yeah, I mean, if you're hydrated. Yeah.
So they're very weak in the hydrated state.
Yes.
So they're are they stronger than other animals in the hydrated state or not really?
So they are only strong in terms of radiation in the hydrated state, which is also very interesting because radiation is like two modes. So you have to shield off the radiation in the first place to be strong, but also you have to be able to recover the broken molecules, repair the broken molecules after the radiation damage. And the repair only works in the active state. So tardigrades are actually stronger for the radiation tolerance in the active state than the anhydrotic state.
Mm. But they couldn't survive space in a hydrated state.
No.
Right. Mm.
Is it
they need oxygen so for respiration.
Is it possible that they came from somewhere else?
No.
They originated here.
Well, so
Nanda.
The tardigrades on the moon are dead. Yes. They didn't come from space.
No. So when we look at the DNA, every life form on Earth, even us, tardigrades, bacteria, anything, have a shared DNA. We all have the same ancestors. So the tardigrades clearly are evolved in not Japan, on Earth. Sorry.
Yeah.
Hmm, soっか. No panspermia.
Well, panspermia is... You would say that's still possible, but it would have to happen long before.
That's if the common ancestor of the life form on Earth came from space. That's possible, yeah, it's just the evasion of the logic. So that life form should have happened somewhere else, and how did it happen? It's not answered. So I don't really want to answer anything with the panspermian hypothesis.
Mm.
Right. So cool.
So do you think they should have sent a different tardigrade to the moon, or what were they trying to do by sending tardigrades to the moon?
I don't know. So my understanding is that it's a religious mission to send the
tardigrade?
No, to send the human society, I mean human culture, or the record of the human presence on the Earth to... Mm. The universe. So it's kind of like the initial Voyager, which carried out one plate, including many of the languages and the pictures of humans and animals and things. So they were kind of like, well, it's my understanding, so it could be wrong, but my understanding from the news is that they were trying to like imitate the Noah's Ark, where they included a lot of the human written things, data, and also some of the seas and the living forms, which can be stored in the dormant state. And one of them was suggested tardigrade to be had.
Oh, I see.
So maybe they were hoping that aliens would find it and rehydrate the tardigrades in the future or something like that?
Yeah.
Is that feasible?
If it's feasible, if it's contained in a reasonable manner.
Mm.
Oh, sorry. This is long.
Oh.
I just have to wait. Sorry.
Do you know who?
No, it's probably Amazon or something. They can just leave it downstairs. So sorry. So long, right?
Yep.
All right. Where were we? Moon tardigrade on the moon.
Moon tardigrade.
Oh, aliens hydrating them. Yeah, and they'll be like, oh, so cute.
Well, this rehydrating thing, we do it with food.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it seems to work pretty well. You know, you buy like...
The freeze-dried.
Yeah, cup noodle.
Yes.
And it's like shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're so used to it now. It doesn't surprise us that much. But some of the freeze-dried food is like... food, it's like it comes back to life almost. You know,
what happens if tardigrade gets totally dried up and then naka chotto mizu kakaru kedo naka hanbun gurai mitai naka hanbun dake かかっちゃったらどうなるんです
か? That's a very small amount of water. Even a single drop of water would probably completely hydrate the tardigrades. So I'm not sure if that is even possible because the water molecules have surface tension, so they tend to form some kind of droplet. And you cannot really spray particles of water.
Right.
So I think any size of reasonable water droplet would completely hydrate the tardigrades. So tardigrades are that small.
I see.
Hmm. I haven't even thought about the smallest possible droplet of water.
Yeah, me neither.
It's like, it's just all so small. So you can't see a tardigrade with your naked eyes, even if you have the best eyes in the world?
So the largest tardigrade known is 2 millimeters. So you can actually observe that with your naked eye.
Where are they?
It's in Sweden.
Sweden.
Mm. Yes. Why is it big?
Well, I don't know.
Hmm.
So it's the largest tardigrade, and it's really yellow tardigrade. Yeah. So it's very observable when you make it out.
Do the locals know about it? Like, do they?
It's in a specific island of Sweden, so I don't know how many people are there.
Is that the only big one?
Yes.
Wow.
Other ones are probably like 500 micrometers.
You can't see
0.5 millimeters larger. So you can see it as a like speck dots.
Mm.
But
it's nimity, do they walk fast or slow?
No, they're
really
very slow. Because they are tardigrades, you know, slow walkers.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about, you know, the red tiny
spider
bugs?
Mites.
Is that the thing? Like, you know, in like books and stuff?
Oh, yes.
The like little bright red.
Yeah, those are the mites. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Like, they move really fast, right? Mm. I mean, they're small, but they walk super fast. So I was kind of imagining that, but I guess they...
But they're much larger. So they're about 1 millimeter in size, and they're mites, so they are close to spider kind of families. But because they have segmented legs, they're much more easy to walk faster.
そっか。だからこのムチムチした足が、だから関節がない。ないっていうか、足にはない。付
け根で動いてますね。
そっか、だから遅いんだ。
Do they make any sound?
Maybe.
Have you tried recording the sound?
A good enough amplification of the speak microphones.
Like, how do they find each other? Like, is there mating calls or?
So there could be pheromones that the female is just exerting out.
Female is?
I think so, because as we observe the mating behavior, the males are attracted to females. So I think the female is. Yeah.
So we don't know if they have any capability to vocalize or make...
Oh, they don't vocalize, no. There's no vocal cord.
But maybe they make sound some other way, or we're not sure?
Sound is simply...
Do they have ears?
Vibration? No, they don't.
Okay.
So they can't hear.
So any movement would probably make a very small sound, but
like a squishy.
I don't know if you can really record it, like the tardigrade.
If you could, what do you think it would? What do things sound like at that scale? Like,
don't know.
Hmm.
水の中でもこう足を動かしてこう泳ぐみたいな感じですか？
いや、泳がないです。歩きます。
もう足歩く。
はい。うん。だからあそうか海のクマムシとかだと多分流されてるんだと思います、で浮き輪みたいななんかそのヒラヒラしたものとかが周りにあったりとかするので、まあ、それで多分普段流されていてで、まあ、海底とかに沈殿した時にはそこで歩く
ああなるほど
Are they can they withstand pressure like if they
Yes.
so they can go deep in the ocean
Yes so the deepest location tardigrades are found is about 4,000 meters beneath
Whoa.
the surface
That's deep.
So they're on top of mountains. They're 4,000 meters deep. They're in the moss outside.
Yeah.
And this is the same physical body that can do
these
this?
These are all different species.
Hmm. So it's not like one species can do each of these things?
No.
Hmm. So there's like a Sherpa type tardigrade that's like comfortable on top of mountains. And then there's an ocean type.
There must be tons of them, right? Because in the ocean, otherwise, how would they find each other?
So many of the tardigrades in the oceans live by the shores.
Okay.
So they can't probably meet, but yeah, I mean, nothing is really known much about the marine tardigrades.
Because otherwise, I mean, if they can't really move, or even if they can, it's just...
So the very common tardigrade that's being researched are the marine tardigrades is the tardigrades that live in the barnacles. So the barnacle Fujitsubo no naka ni sunde te. So there are tens of tardigrades of one species living in one barnacle, and that is a very enclosed environment where you can really easily find mates.
That makes sense.
Wait, so there are multiple species of tardigrade living in the same exact place?
No, just a single species.
Oh.
It's like the entire tribe, right? Like a village of tardigrades.
In the barnacle,
How do you think about... you know, the human body has a bunch of cells.
Mm-hmm.
And we consider the cells alive.
Yes.
And we have... It's kind of like a colony of different small, I mean, you wouldn't say organisms, but this idea that sort of the fractal idea that we're made of a bunch of smaller living things and that we our experience is sort of just the emergent level of that. And I guess the idea that we are part of this planetary organism, you know, because we're just so evolved into the environment that we emerge into. It's like us and our ecosystem. Do you think about that in terms of the definition of life? Because at the scale of like tardigrades, humans start to look really strange, I think.
So as an entity, the human individual or the tardigrade individual all share the same genome within cells, within the body. So it's not really that weird because the body of that complex of the cells is made up from the same original information. And so in terms of the information that you have inherited in the DNA, it's not that difficult to define the individual. And it's not really different from tardigrades to humans.
Well, like between us, so we're probably 99.99 or something percent identical DNA, right? And so the the information you actually need to describe an individual is like extremely small from a DNA standpoint, is that correct?
Yes, from the DNA standpoint, but what is formed as a result from the expression of the DNA is highly complex because, so each individual's contains several million different DNA nucleotide changes, but the formation of the organism is the result of the interaction of those. So that even if the building blocks are different at like 3 million points, the complex result is 3 million, over 3 million different interactions. The outcome is much more complex.
I'm trying to get a sense of how different humans actually are from each other. You know, from a human standpoint, you know, we talk about each other's personalities, or this person is like Beijing, this person's not, and you know, these sorts of judgments. But from like an objective, like outside perspective, you know, like, are we as similar as animals tend to be to each other, or are we much...
We are really similar because we had a very very short bottlenecking time in history. So the mitochondria Eve, which is probably the origin of all humankind that's living on the surface of the planet right now, was probably there several thousand to tens of thousand years ago, which is very short in terms of the evolutionary time. So many other species do not have that kind of bottlenecking, or if they had the bottlenecking, that would be several, so
like billions of years.
Billion is nanjuku,
so tens of millions.
Tens of millions.
Yeah.
Yeah. of years before. So in that scale, many other species are much more diverse than humans. So the humans that we that currently live on Earth is very limited, and we are just very, very tiny differences within them.
We're all the same.
Yeah, we are all the same.
Interesting.
Yeah, you don't really look at it from the outside. Mm. And so we focus on the differences.
I mean, right? Look at the dogs.
Yeah.
Like Chihuahuas to St. Barnards, and these are all the same species.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty wild. I mean, that's totally different from how Asians look and Caucasians look and everything. The, even the shapes and the size is totally different.
Yeah, I think about that a lot lately because So my son looks at Chihuahua and says "wang wang," and he looks at Golden Retriever and he says "wang wang." Mm. It's like, how can you tell that they're both "wang wang"? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if we become extinct and millions of years pass, and there's another intelligent species on Earth, and then they dig up a fossil of Chihuahuas and St. Barnards. I don't think they can tell these are the same species from just the fossil evidence.
And something like that wouldn't happen without human intervention, right?
It could.
It could?
Yes. So geological separation, as happened in the Darwin's finches, is it's simply a natural cause.
I guess that's why islands are so interesting.
Yes.
Right. Like the Nimirino tardigrade is on islands too, right?
Yes.
I mean Swedish
island.
So it's contained geographically or it's ecologically?
Actually, there are several different species recently found in that group of tardigrades. So some of them actually live in Italy and other parts of Europe as well. So these are not exactly the same species, but very similar and large as well.
So we don't have those large ones in Japan.
No.
That's too bad.
I have some in my fridge, but
that's probably only one. Do you? You can just keep them in the fridge or in the freezer,
in a 100% state. So when you dry it, you can keep it for years, and you want to avoid oxidation of that sample, so you keep it in the fridge.
So you have tardigrades frozen in your. In your fridge?
Oh, yeah. Lots of tardigrades and lots of spiders.
Wow. Spiders, too?
Yes. Because I've seen 1,000 spiders from all over the world. So a lot of the specimens, which have not yet been seen, are still remaining in the freezer.
Wow.
You gotta make sure.
Probably people will be scared.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of people have phobia, right?
Well, you need to make sure the power doesn't go out and they rehydrate and come back to life.
Well, the immediate power off wouldn't rehydrate itself if you don't have flooding and anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's okay. But the deep freezer, we obviously have backup supplies. So
yeah, but it's weird to worry about something in your fridge coming back to life. Most people don't worry about that sort of thing.
The spiders wouldn't come back to life. When we freeze them, they've already died.
They're dead.
They found that some fish have that sort of capability.
Oh, yeah.
For
amphibians, too, like frogs.
Hmm. And why don't their cells get destroyed when they freeze?
That's interesting, too. Yeah. So you have to freeze them in a very special way, usually flash freezing with the liquid nitrogen, which is so fast that the ice structures of the spikes of the water molecules wouldn't form in the organism. So that would entirely freeze the water molecule at once. So the gradual freezing makes gradual crystals of water, which forms like tiny spikes, which can damage the cells. But if you freeze everything at once, those tiny crystals wouldn't form.
Just like the fertilized eggs that I have. They use the
What is it about the speed of the freezing that is preventing the crystallization?
So crystallization is a slow process of growing the molecule. So if you freeze it at once with liquid nitrogen, they don't
usually... It doesn't crystallize?
So much. So there is still some crystals, and there is still some damage. So that's why Walt isn't, if he's frozen, it isn't likely to come back to life. Mm-hmm. But some of the amphibians probably have more tolerant cells, and they can come back to life.
So they evolved that ability naturally because they get frozen sometimes, or
maybe, and also some osmotic pressures can be related to too. So the loss of water is linked to many other things in many ways. So like the salinity changes, so the the freshwater environment to the marine environment, there's a salinity changes, so the cells have to cope with the osmotic pressure that's being applied. So that is kind of related to desiccation tolerance as well, because if you have osmotic changes, you have a rapid sucking out of water, and that is kind of like imitating to the desiccation tolerance. And freezing is also similar to desiccation tolerance in a way that the liquid state of water is being lost.
Mm.
So everything is very linked in that sense.
Could they, if they continue to increase the speed at which they're able to freeze things, or, I mean, are we at the theoretical limit for flash freezing things? Or, like, if you could freeze something, like, instantly, would that give us an even better result for preserving the
structure? Liquid nitrogen is very cold. So it was, is it 120 degrees Celsius? So I forgot the exact temperature, but it's very cold. So it also, at that stage, it mostly depends on the size of the thing that you would try to freeze. So if you want to freeze a large object, the temperature change gradually happens from the outside to the inside.
Mm.
And so if you want to freeze a very large object, the inner part would probably still grow some crystals of ice.
Mm.
But tardigrades are so small, if you freeze in, it's almost frozen in an instant.
Mm. Walt Disney is just too big.
It's too big.
So the things like the tadpoles or the some small frogs or goldfish, the small goldfish, can be flash frozen and then come back to life. But maybe it's not possible for very large fish or the very large goldfish or the large frogs and everything else.
Did you start in bioinformatics, or
yes,
how did you get interested in that initially?
Well, when I was in high schools and middle schools, I also wanted to know what is life and why we are living and the kind of a Chunibyo kind of stuff. And I really read a lot of books in religion and philosophy to try to understand, but everything really didn't really appeal to me because it's not really scientific and defined in the mathematical terms. So you kind of understand it, but what you really do understand is when it's really stated in the mathematical form. And at that time, many of the genome projects were going on, and decoding the genome, as the newspaper said at the time, really seemed to appeal to me, because if you really know the origin of the blueprint of the life, and if you really understand the letters of DNA as it stands, you totally kind of understand what the life's basic, the architecture is. And so I went into bioinformatics field to analyze the genomes, and then eventually to simulate the organisms in mathematical terms to understand how the life is functioning as a system. But eventually I came to, the barrier that where I don't really understand what the definition of life is. And then I went into studying the genome sequences with the spiders and the living system of tardigrades.
Do you believe in God?
Depends on how you define God.
Do you believe that there's some kind of explanation for the universe and for human beings and...
Explanation. So, isn't that physics? So, in terms of the social creation, the creation of humankind as a society to agree on some being which is called God to try to explain something which is not explained yet is understandable.
Do you think that, I don't know, do you think the universe cares about us, or do you think humans are just another product of sort of the chaotic processes of the universe, and there's
well,
nothing...
The universe doesn't have a mind, so it doesn't really care, but humans is just a species of the living system that has only one submersion, Earth, and it's been prevailing for 3 billion years since. And my hypothesis is that why humans came on Earth is that... 日本語でもいいですか。ちょっと英語で疲れてきちゃった。その生物って、変異をしてなんかずっと例外を作り続けるっていうことをやってきてるんですよね。でだからもともと1個の生き物だったんだけどちょっとずつ変わっていって、そのどれかがどこかの環境で残ってる。でだからいろんな環境に残れるためにいろんな種類を作っていて、で、まあ、結果としてそれがいろんなところで成功していると。でまあ、生物としてはそれでずっと残していきたいわけなんですよ。どんな環境が来ても例外を作って。でその究極の例外って、地球がなくなることも考慮しなきゃいけないと思うんですね。で50億年とか100億年経つと太陽が膨張を始めて、地球が、まあ、多分ハビタブルじゃなくなってくると思うんですね。その時に生き物が、地球がなくなっちゃったら地球の生き物全部なくなりますっていうふうには多分したくないと思うんですよ。まあ、そこにはもちろん意思はないんだけど、進化ってそれから避けるようなことをしてるから、まあ、その相違としては多分そういうふうに考えることができる。そうすると地球外に生命を持ってくっていうことができる生き物を作るだろうなと思うんですよ。で僕は人類ってそれなんじゃないかなというふうに思ってて、その知的生命を、まあ知的な思考を持つことによって道具を使えるようになって、で好奇心を持ってるから宇宙に行きたくなってきて、今宇宙にどんどんロケットとか飛ばして、まあ、これから50年100年すれば多分別の惑星にも行くわけですよね。でその時に、僕ら多分勝手に生き物を連れてっちゃうんです。それは生き物を食べ物として持ってくために持ってくだろうし、あとは普通にコンタミネーションとして、地球から生き物ってどうしてもついてきちゃうの でそれがクマムシみたいなものとか、あるいはバクテリアでもいいんですけど、別の惑星に行った時に、まあ、たまたまそこでまた進化し始めちゃうのは多分いると思うんですね。ある意味パンスペルミア、地球から持ってってるパンスペルミアだと思うんですけど、でそれが長いスケールでその50億年とかで見た時には多分太陽系にどんどん広がっていって、まあ、いずれは銀河にどんどん広がっていくっていうことになるんだと思うんですけど、まあ、そういう生き物の地球の生命の、ベクターというかシャトルとしてね、人というのが誕生してきて、で広げるための役割を担わされてるんだと思います。そこに多分自由意志はない。
Well, it seems
強制的にミディアムとして。
It seems logical that only entities which are entirely devoted to persisting would exist.
Yes.
Given a certain amount of time. So it seems tardigrades want to persist in everything that we see. We wouldn't see it unless it was programmed to try to persist. So you think we're kind of a way for life on Earth to persist beyond sort of the planetary
Earth.
Boundary?
Yes.
I mean, certainly. I mean, do you see an impulse to persist beyond our genome in sort of like a digital informational way that is outside of our genetic legacy?
I think that's also a possibility, that we extend the use of information to bring out life in that form. Yes, but that would use a lot of facilities and resources outside of the natural environment, which is on the other planet. So the molecular resources that are available in the molecular planet, and you have to build some kind of computers which can program those information, and I don't think that's really sustainable from the life's perspective.
What is sustainable for human beings in the
So I'm not speaking in terms of the humans. I'm only speaking in terms of the organism that has happened on Earth as a whole. So for the organism that that's happened on the Earth as a whole, doesn't really care if the human becomes extinct. Other forms of the life would still be surviving. Maybe tardigrades can be a long-lasting one in this respect. And so if that kind of information-based life is created by humans, they will depend on humans for the facility to survive. But maybe they can produce robots from their perspective to sustain themselves in that region again. But that would require creating that environment for them, and which is a little bit extra effort to just adapt to the environment itself. So I think life as a whole doesn't really need that. So it's very exciting to imagine that kind of a development happen. And I think it's kind of inevitable that we will actually produce that kind of things online somewhere, maybe not on Earth, but somewhere in the universe. But as a life that's been happened on Earth, it's not a necessity to continue in that direction.
It seems like as unnecessary as it is, and as much as people have concerns about artificial intelligence and its effects on human beings, it seems like we can't slow it down, like our own creation of it. And that seems like a sort of a species level calling, where it's like any individual member of the species can't like control humanity. You know, like you don't really have that much control. I don't have that much control. The human species is, on a species level, it's only something that we effectively observe, you know.
We just can't help it.
I mean, we're not completely helpless, you know, but if one person changed the course of all of humanity, then that's usually a rare event, I think.
Yeah, so I think it relates to what is the most common or primitive thing that we share as humans. And I think curiosity is what you're talking about. And curiosity is one of the very basic nature that we have as humans.
I must know the truth.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Probably nature and love for the humankind or even the world around us is another thing that we have as nature, as a human being, which is not possessed by other organisms on Earth.
Why do you think there are entities in this universe in the first place?
Entities.
Like differentiated entities. So we start with, we can start like the self-assembling RNA level, but you have these differentiated entities and you have this experiment being run where something creates copies of itself and they sort of see which one does the best, and we run that process over and over. But like, why have entities in the first place?
Because selection acts on entities, and nothing can be universally tolerant. So if you want to be... So robustness and tolerance is kind of like a trade-off. So if you want to adapt to some environment, you lose robustness to adapt to environment to other environments. So you will need to have different entities surviving in different populations as a backup, so you don't get extinct as a whole.
Right.
So different species can be extinct, but the life on Earth is not never extinct as a whole.
But if you imagine the universe without any animals and no entities, you wouldn't really expect there to suddenly emerge like sensors. It seems like, so each entity is kind of like a sensor, and that entity is trying to produce a more accurate model of the world. And so each sensor...
Model of the local environment, not the world itself, because the...
Well, eventually the world, but not for that individual member of the species, but it's all working towards modeling of the entire universe. The information describing the universe just improves as each of these differentiated entities add more sensors, add ways to collect more information about the environment, and then create a more accurate and descriptive model inside of each entity's head. And so when we're like this conversation right now, we're comparing our differentiated modelings of this universe that we're living in. And so like the universe is creating millions and millions and millions of increasingly accurate in resolution models of itself within itself.
So you're talking about the human knowledge as a whole.
Well,
that's based on the cognitive intelligence. So,
well, it's we couldn't get here without the much simpler sensor level entities. You know, like single cell organism with flagella that can like detect contact or something, and then they develop a sensor for detecting photons, and then they develop ways, like we were talking about earlier, a sense of where you are, sort of this conquest of dimensionality. So the dimensions are increasing. That and
not
now
always,
we're,
because our vision is very limited to the visible light, but other insects and bats can look at infrared or some UV. Vision range, which is outside of humans, and some of the organisms have much better night scope and more sense the echoes coming back.
Like our memory gives us a four-dimensional navigational capability that most previous entities in our world have not been able to develop, and that I think that gives us a huge evolutionary advantage as an entity that's trying to model our environment. And so when I imagine this and I imagine the sensor suites and the dimensionality and how it confers evolutionary advantage, it's very interesting to imagine that in the future, because you would imagine, you wouldn't expect there to be a decrease in sensors or a decrease in dimensionality. We have actually augmented ourselves with artificial sensors all over the entire planet. All kinds of sensors where we can see infrared now. We can see like, and all of these things we're using to model the universe at increasing accuracy in order to make predictions which increase our ability to persist. Does that make sense? So like,
yeah, so you're talking about the human species only, so that kind of is a track away from the previous discussion about the entire organism. But the humans are actually using technology to enhance our sensing. That is, so, but as an organism, we are not necessarily sensing as much as some other organisms, which are specialized. So some bacteria really have specified sensors to different metal compounds that are available in the environment, which we obviously do not have, but we can obviously with the tools. But how we perceive those information is totally dependent on what we use as a technology. So as an organism, we are not necessarily superior to other organisms in terms of sensing.
But in terms of our modeling of the world, so I kind of imagine that if you look at a timeline of life forms, that the utility of that modeling predictably increases over time as evolution progresses. Like, do you think of evolution as a process?
Don't think that is evolution. It's only a change within the human species. So the evolutionary outcome from the human species does not necessarily have our kind of senses or our kind of cognitive intelligence. It could be a very different form, which we cannot really predict.
So I have
outside of evolution.
But I have this idea that so at the very beginning of after the emergence of life, that there's that it's much simpler. There are less sensors. There's less ability to model the environment, and that sort of the state of the art tools within animals has been advancing over time.
But I don't think so.
That's not necessarily true.
No, because
So it's a coincidence that we're so advanced and we're in the present. That's a total coincidence?
Yes, I think so.
Wow. That it would be the most mind-blowing thing to me.
So that comes back to my previous discussion about humans being the shuttle vectors to carry the life forms from the Earth. So if we produce a lot of the carriage of the living system from the outside of the planet of Earth to different planets, and then the intelligent species can be extinct in all of those planets, but life form will still survive. And that is the basic tactics of the life form as a whole. It's not really the aim is to create the knowledge or the model of the thing, but you want to just keep spreading in space.
And you don't think that our ability to so being able to model the environment and being able to persist is more a phenomenon just among human beings and not necessarily like other life forms on Earth?
I don't think so.
That would be really crazy.
Because there is no aim or anything as a natural environment. So everything is based on selection and survival of the fittest. So if the survival is fittest if the survival is fittest for the intelligent species, the intelligent species survives for that instance. But that instance can easily change. And then the survival, the optimization parameter for the survival can be something else. Sorry. And in that case, humans can simply be extinct, but other life form would be proliferating in that environment. We are just here for the last, 50,000 years, which is just an instant in the history, in evolution history of our lives.
Well, if you think about like technology and even like 1,000 years ago,
much less. Like it's like more like 200 years.
Yeah.
After the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
After the laws of, Netsuri Kigaku.
So you think
thermodynamics? Yeah.
So this is like a strong anthropic principle, as in like you think we're here in the present not as the culmination of an evolutionary process, but we're like it's more tamatama.
Yes.
It's
that's like obviously.
That's crazy.
I just
that makes everything crazier.
Do most people think that? What do most people think about this?
Well, I think most biologists think of like that. But humans tend to think in terms of human as the center of the universe and everything in the human-centric way. And then it's a natural consequence that you think that way.
What if we are, though? Then we are making a mistake to rule ourselves out. Because we look all over the universe. We have looked at many, many, not up close, but we've observed so much of space and so many stars near us. I mean, we can now identify planets and more or less their composition and whatnot. But we don't see anything. Like, what do you think of the sort of the Drake equation problem or like that we don't see aliens? Like,
We only look at very close regions of the universe, so we can't really see that far in the universe yet.
But we've seen so many systems. So like,
but not at the resolution. So,
you think it's if we had better resolution, you would expect to see life forms on many, many systems?
In terms of life, so I think we have a lot of life forms. I don't know if there are intelligent life forms. I'm not sure if intelligent life forms even exist in the universe. I'm not sure if we're intelligent.
Yeah, we're trying. What do you think?
No, I had never really thought about this, like, life as a whole thing. Like, oh, as long as, you know, someone survives, then that's fine.
That's the basic strategy of the life. Yes.
That's interesting to me, because I don't know, like, we live as a human and we see things from human perspectives and we talk about environmental issues and whatever, and we're like, oh, we've been, you know, destroying rainforests and killing all these animals and we have to save certain animals, like that kind of stuff. So it's always like, you know, like, 違うし versus じゃないけど、なんか別に対立してるわけじゃないけど、なんか I never really thought of like it as a,
I mean, like life as a society, as a whole. Yeah, it's a natural thing that you have to think about in terms of humans. And obviously the time span that you think in terms of making policies is in the order of years to maybe in the longer way, it's several decades as a human sedai generations. So what I'm talking about is in the evolutionary scale, so in the years of the billions of years. And if you consider the billions of years, the planet Earth wouldn't last more than 100 billion years, because the sun is going to start bojo expanding, and that will raise the temperatures on the surface of Earth, and it's probably not really habitable for many of the organisms that are currently living here. Some of the organisms that are living underground, or the bacteria, which can survive the thermal heat of up to like 200 degrees Celsius, can probably still be alive, but that would not be available in the next 200 billion years, because some would explode in them, and the solar system would be gone. And in those scenarios, in those scenarios, I think the life would try to proliferate outside of the planet, and as we expand to the space as a humankind, we carry the organisms around the solar systems and then eventually out of the solar system, and then those organisms would still be there even if the planet Earth, I mean sun, explodes and planet Earth goes away, and maybe there's no resource to sustain the different organisms, but the organisms would still be there somewhere in the universe.
It's interesting that the goals are matching, like humans are trying to go to Mars, not because the sun is going to explode, right? It's not really in our timeline, at least for now. But in the end, like, life as a whole and humans, like, our goals are kind of in the same line.
Yeah.
If you look at the fossil record of Earth, it's very clear that there's a reset mechanism where the outer regions of, I mean, I think it's, yeah, but asteroids and comets are routinely fired into the inner planet area, and that causes what appears to be some kind of reset mechanism on the life on Earth, and it seems to prevent a sort of a stalling out with one sort of dominant you know, like the dinosaurs or something. Have you thought about asteroids in like an evolutionary perspective? Or because if we're
asteroids are not that really big in terms of perturbations, because, well, it's famous for killing out all the dinosaurs, but dinosaurs are very large organisms, and in terms of the bacteria or smaller organisms, they have been surviving billions of years, and tardigrades have been there for more than 500 million years on Earth. So they have emerged on Earth before the Cambrian, and they've been here since, and the species are different. The speciation has happened since then, so they are not the same species, but they've been here for a very long time. So in terms of the global changes, there is a snowball Earth effect several hundred million years ago. And then large changes in the percentage of carbon dioxide after the tertiarization of the plants. And, And those changes are much more drastic in terms of the entire scale of the mm. Earth. Yes.
Mm. There have been like six or seven like major extinction events,
mm.
like in the fossil record. Do you like this idea that human beings can help life persist past the expansion of the sun? Do you think, like, if humans didn't exist, then the Earth would just be, like, all life on Earth would just be...
wiped out?
Wiped out.
I think the Earth, or the life as a whole, would have produced some kind of intelligent species to do that. Or maybe some more, like, dormants, like the tardigrades, would have evolved, which kind of, like, flashed... seas of organisms outside of space.
Hmm.
So you think that with or without humans, it will go towards that direction?
Yes. Now, how does it...
Huh, interesting.
Where does the evolutionary...
drive?
Like pressure or pressure come from to like get off the planet?
Hmm.
No, it's just a coincidence, so it's just a chance.
Hmm. So it's not like it's trying to do this.
It's not trying.
Like, does the Earth know that the sun's going to explode?
No, there is no intelligence on Earth or the life as a whole. So it's just a coincidence. But the strategy of life is just to try every kind of possibility to survive with any kind of perturbations from outside. So.
But isn't
eventually
it,
they would try.
So that includes sun exploding.
Yes, so any exception is a target of a life to evade.
Hmm.
It's weird to
obviously
think
there is no target, though. I mean, it's a consequence of the evolutionary system.
Hmm.
There is no mind or something like that.
Right.
But
controlling it.
It's interesting that mind could be part of the larger mechanisms.
Well, that's just my... imagination or hypothesis. I mean, it's not even a hypothesis, it's more like a wild dream, but
I kind of tend to think
of the human species as that way.
Hmm.
The cordyceps mushroom fungi will infect an ant, and it will make that ant climb to the highest point on the plant, like automatically. The ant has no idea what's going on, but it will go up to the highest point, and then it doesn't know this, but the reason why it's going to the highest point is so its head can explode and then the spores can like travel the maximum distance, you know? So sometimes I think like human beings are kind of like the ant and we are being made to, you know, all the iPhones and the rest of all the crazy stuff we're doing. We're being made to go to the highest point in order to get the largest possible jumping distance, which in this case needs to be like to the next planet.
Yes. Yeah,
so,
that's basically what I think about, yeah.
It's like a... So that metaphor kind of makes sense.
Mm, yes.
Mm.
But the fungi itself, it doesn't have a mind, so it's just a...
Right, the fungi has some other ulterior
motive.
Agenda, yeah.
So are we in control of ourselves, or are we being subverted by some other...
We are more happily lived if we think we are controlled...
I mean, so life is really strong. If this is all right, then life persists no matter what.
Yes, that's why it's been here for 3 billion years.
Mm.
From the same single ancestor.
It makes me feel so optimistic suddenly about like everything. I don't know.
So we are just that's very instant time frame in the evolutionary scale, and humans are just nothing. We're just an instant.
Mm.
We're so lucky that we can actually escape the sun exploding. Because, you know, if the Earth was slightly heavier, it would become almost completely impossible for us to get off this planet. So it's like just barely. I mean, do you have any...
If we were larger, we would have received, I mean, and if we didn't have the moon of the right size, we would be receiving much more comets.
Mm-hmm.
And that would scrape off the planet with the comet like the moon. And then some of them will be in the orbit, but some of them will fly away from the solar system. And those events can also be used as a chance for the species and life to get out of the planet. And life can use those possibilities too. So I think it's just an instance of a planet of being this size and this distance apart from the sun, and having this very right size of the moon, which protects all the comets that are flying to our planet. But if the situation is different, the life can obviously take different strategies to do that too.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I always thought like, oh yeah, like, so, you know, this size thing, oh, like Earth is in the perfect size, and the distance from the sun, it's like, you know, oh wow, it's so perfect. And if it was slightly different, then it would have been way harsher, and, you know, but then, yeah, I guess someone would survive anyway, no matter what. And
well, that's like, it's like, it's either perfect or you don't exist. Does that sound right?
But if you solve the Drake's equation, there are several right occasions in the universe, because there are so many planets and the planets like the sun, which are burning.
Oh, like a dwarf?
Not satellite, but fixed star, just star.
Star, okay, yeah.
I guess in English.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we cannot really count the number of planets which are outside of our visible range, because they don't exert light. So we are only seeing planets in the far universes. We are only counting the suns, stars in the far universes, but we can expect a certain number of planets to be located around those stars. So, with the availability of so many stars in the universe, I think there are some chance that, there are, I think, many chances that life has evolved in many of the locations in the universe. But
so you believe in aliens?
That's a different story. So I don't know if intelligent species are there, but life would obviously be there. So it could be some form like bacteria, which is very...
We're intelligent.
I don't know. I don't know if we're intelligent.
Okay, so if we assume that we're intelligent,
yes,
then would you say that there are intelligent... Like, we can't be a divine exception. We would be like gods.
Organism would be available in the universe. I mean, I like to hope.
Like intelligent as in life forms that are aware of the surrounding environment enough to know that there's outer space and that kind of stuff? Or?
Yeah, but we...
I mean, it depends on the definition, right?
We don't really know that much of the universe, so... In terms of the understanding of the surrounding environment, I don't know if humans are intelligent.
We're more intelligent than like koalas and like most other. I mean, is there?
But
some
the changes are very marginal. So the evolutionary time the koalas evolved on Earth to the time humans evolved on Earth is a very short time. It's only like it's less than 100 million years. But in the planetary, like galactic scale, if you look at the different, we're talking about life forms in different star systems, and the evolutionary time could be different in the order of billions of years. So the chance of intelligence between humans and koalas are just marginal.
But I have my iPhone, and I can Google stuff, so I'm way smart. A koala can't Google.
No, but, we're talking about aliens, right? So they might be like billions of years ahead of us.
Yes, and if they are billions of years ahead, they feel that we are like bacteria.
Right.
They're already here. I mean,
yeah, well, yeah, I always say this, but I love the Hogochiku like theory, where like which explains the Fermi paradox, that like we don't see any aliens and aliens are not coming here because this is like a designated preserved area, like primitive
We're in a zoo
area, and yeah, they're like prohibited to like touch us.
If our intelligence is billion years of evolutionary time apart, I mean, that is how we consider algae or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we wouldn't really care about them.
Yeah.
They must exist, right? If there's life out there in the universe, and if star systems like our own have been available in this universe for many billions of years now, and so evolution could have gotten a head start on us by billions and billions of years. And if you have that many experiments running, then certainly some of them would have developed intelligent life, at least to our level.
So as I said earlier, I'm quite sure that intelligent form have evolved sometime in the universe somewhere, but they could have been extinct. So they could have exist, but we're not sure if they exist now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And the surviving organism may not be intelligent in that scale.
So do you think if we get, let's say human beings are 100 times smarter than we are now, but if we do that, does our probability of survival go up?
I'm not sure, because that totally depends on the resources that we use.
Hmm. What if you define intelligence by as probability of survival, or is that weird?
In that case, bacteria is the most intelligent organism.
Hmm.
Maybe it is.
Yes. So that's why us as a species of humans may not survive that long. So, I mean, just considering the length of a species surviving, the humans have only a chance of surviving, 1 million years or several million years at maximum. And we will probably speciate into different species or get extinct in the order of several tens or 100 million years. So,
Well, I hope not.
We will.
we will go extinct.
I think so.
I mean, in that sense, it's not. It doesn't look really so smart, right?
No organisms have survived billions of years.
Mm. But there is a lineage to the present moment.
Yes, so there is a continuation of life, but not as a species of humans.
Yeah.
Mm.
But maybe we would still be okay with having some kind of life descendant, even if it's not human. And
yes, but in that case, so we are descendant of chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
But do we consider chimpanzees as our kin?
I give them a lot of credit. They did a good job.
But we don't really, value them as a person. I mean, they're not.
Oh my god, we have them at the zoo.
Yeah, we have
them. For God's sake,
yeah. Yeah. We jail them under the bars. So. If a new species evolved from human species, they wouldn't consider us as a kin.
They'd put us in jail, VR jail or something.
Yeah. Zoo.
Yeah.
And our natural habitat would be taken away.
Mm.
You know, so we take away all the habitats of chimpanzees in Africa, and then the same thing would happen.
Mm.
Yikes.
That's already happened with the Neanderthals and the Homo sapiens just several thousand years ago. Tens of thousand years ago. But that's very short time in the evolutionary history of the biology.
What do you think of writing stuff down?
Mm-hmm.
Like writing things down, like in
like recording things.
Yeah. So on Earth, animals didn't like take notes or like take information from inside their mind and put it, make it permanent. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily permanent, but it can last many, many, many generations.
If you carve it in stones,
yeah.
If you write it in paper, they only survive 10,000 years at maximum. Mm. And if you store it in hard drive, the operating system changes in 3 years or something, and you can't really dig it up. So I have a lot of data still kept in my floppy disks, which I never can survive now.
Yeah.
Even though it's only just, I don't know, several decades ago, we cannot really access the information because there is no drive or right operating system or software to dig up that information. So I think the storage of information is getting much more shortened in the recent years.
Mm. But if you think about animals and evolution, life on Earth as this something being done by RNA and then DNA, for DNA to eventually have to be DNA, which creates an animal that can write DNA. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's some sort of, is there something fundamentally different in terms of information on Earth once DNA creates something that can write DNA? Mm-hmm. Or store information across many generations of animals?
So I think what you're saying is that since humans can modify genomes, we can create new organisms, and then that can be the new kind of evolution. Is that right?
Yeah, some kind of fundamental change in how information is stored on Earth.
I think it doesn't really work because the humans are too greedy, because we tend to think that we are intelligent and we think something is right, but that is easily disproven by the nature, because if natural condition changes, what we think is right is probably not right in that moment. And the nature itself is much more elegant in trying any kinds of possibilities, which we don't even think of. So something that we think is right, like making more Ikemen by genetic modifications, would be a weak point for viruses or something. And then, so we cannot really expect something as a good thing. Anything can be a good thing. So preparing for everything is the right strategy for the life. And humans tend to choose and select what is good and what is bad. So that would not be an optimal strategy for evolution.
What about like physics? Like something like E equals MC squared. There's sort of these profound, almost like a compression of, how would you describe that? Like there are formulas that were written by like scientists like hundreds of years ago that humans have used to make all kinds of elaborate predictions about nature, and like this kind of information transfer, the internet, I mean, doesn't this completely change the fundamental way that evolution works on Earth? Or do you think like if it's like evolution is strictly biological or not necessarily that's the case?
So if a large comet just fly into Earth in the next month or something, or next year even, I think humans can be very easily wiped off of Earth immediately. So intelligence doesn't really happen. I mean, doesn't really help in those regards. So...
Right. Like knowledge, right?
Knowledge is...
Like not
really useful for a very large perturbation that can happen.
Yeah, so like as you said earlier, if you measure intelligence by the likelihood of surviving, then we're not that smart. Relatively speaking, right? Like compared to tardigrades, for example, then tardigrades are way smarter in that sense.
Well, so I wouldn't say it's a smartness. It's a survival.
Right, yeah. Right.
But in terms of survivability, humans are not that strong compared to many different other life forms. So bacteria, tardigrades, and some plants are very strong.
But if we look, if we extend it out to the sun exploding, then we may have an advantage.
We may have an advantage as a carrier to send life forms out, but we are not really that habitable. So we need to create some environment, and we are so much dependent on other species. But some of the single-celled algae or the plant cells can survive on their own if they have enough water, CO2, and sunlight. But we need food, we need PlayStations, we need iPhones, and the facility to run those environments. And we will be really... I don't think we can survive in a resourceless environment. So if we go to Mars and we have to culture everything from zero, so we have to make plants and make nice places to live from the beginning, that would take years, hundreds of years and generations. And I don't think people can really, you know, psychologically fit in that respect.
Mm.
So if terraforming of the Mars, if it takes, let's say, 300 years, that's like 10 generations.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fifth generation, you would be really crazed, mm-hmm. you know, not without all the technology, without mm-hmm. all the fit environment. And
well, like the pyramids took many generations, right? I think.
Well,
like,
but the building environment, the pyramid is very fit because it's on Earth, and you mm-hmm. still have a lot of humans to play with, a lot of animals to hunt, and a lot of food to eat. But on Mars, nothing's there.
Yeah, but they kind of accepted, you know, like when they were building the pyramids, because it was sort of so authoritarian, they don't really care if people die in the process of making the pyramids.
Yeah, but we're not that authoritarian now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why Elon was saying, like, oh, we need to find, like, send someone who's like, willing funny. To die. No, it's funny, like, because you have to think of the psychological mm. aspects too, right?
If yes, and is like... that is probably useful for the first generation,
mm.
but what would happen for third or fourth generations?
Mm.
And they will probably still have internet access and know what is happening on Earth,
mm.
Because that's a human right.
Yeah, that kind of sucks, right? Yes.
Yeah, that really sucks.
Yeah, that's true. If it's just Mars, then whatever. If it's like super hard, like pilgrims... Like, they are super struggling and whatever, and they read the, you know, in UK, everyone's having the Olympics or something. I don't know. Like,
mm-hmm.
that sucks.
But even the pilgrims, you know, there are flowers, there are birds, there are right. animals that you can hunt.
Right. True.
And also, there are usually domestic people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
In Mars, there's nothing. There's no river, there's no plant, there's no nothing. And you can't, you only. Confined in a closed environment because there's no oxygen
mm.
enough to survive on the Mars surface, so you have like this kind of dome probably mm. where you can only live, and that's like a social distancing for the entire life.
Yeah.
you might need it though, because the world is so interconnected now and so globalized now that I think in some ways the world is more vulnerable to certain threats than it was before.
Yeah,
for sure.
And certainly the.
Experiencing that right now with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Yeah. The coronavirus wouldn't make it to Mars, I'm assuming, if we had both planets colonized. Someone would really have to screw that up to get Mars infected.
Yeah.
But what do you make of the virus situation? With your background in bioinformatics, I imagine you might have some insight into that.
Well, that's outside my expertise, so I wouldn't really want to comment too much on it, but numbers are really growing in exponential phase all over the world. Maybe a little bit contained in Korea, in some parts of Asia, but it's skyrocketing in many parts of Europe and the United States.
Mm.
And that will keep crossing for several more months, I guess. So in Japan, we are experiencing the second wave. So the first wave that came from China has been relatively under control, although the number of new patients has been rising, almost doubling every week.
Mm.
So it wasn't really that much contained. But still, everything else is much in the exponential phase. So
mm.
we will have a very tough year, or two or three.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I just want to let the listeners know that this is March 26th today.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Hopefully we're all fine still.
This episode is probably coming out in like a month or so.
Okay.
So just to mm. let everybody know.
Mm. Yeah, they'll be more in a separate situation when they're listening to this.
Yeah. It will certainly be a different situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're not so optimistic about our ability to contain its...
It's not contained now, so it will never be contained in the near future. Mm. And, it's outside my expertise, so I cannot really say for sure, but the creation of vaccines will be very difficult. It will at least take a year to probably really totally test on humans. And coronavirus vaccines seem to have an activating side effect for the immune system. So you have to be very careful to develop the vaccine. So I think a vaccination would have to wait more than 1 year to happen. And since many of the humid countries are already seeing expansions in the infections, as in Vietnam, Thailand, or the Southeast Asia right now, so we cannot really expect to have a seasonal depression of the infection, as many people are talking about. So, you know, if we can wait until the summer, the infection will be slower. And it could be slower, but it wouldn't be that much slower, as we're seeing a lot of infections in warmer and more humid countries around the globe. So there are infections in Australia, which is in summer right now. So it would be a very tough year, I guess.
What do you think of how the government has been handling this?
Oh.
Even more outside your expertise.
Well,
just as an individual opinion.
Yeah, it's as an individual opinion. Well, Japan is not doing a very good job there.
Right.
What about other countries? Are they doing it better or about the same? Or
so I think Korea is doing a very good job, and I'm really surprised that China has really have everything in control now, and they have much less death than the current number of deaths. And Italy, the number of infections may also be surpassed by United States quite soon. And if you think about the number of infections per millions of people, they're doing a very good job since there's so much Chinese population in the country. So some parts of the world are doing good, but since the situation is so global, you have to, even if you control the situation within the country, you have to keep shutting down the country until everything settles down. Otherwise, people who are getting the virus can come back and then become the source of infection again. So unless you have a total immunity in the population or a vaccination, this situation wouldn't settle. So,
Well, that seems like a very dark portrayal of things to come. Do you think it will become endemic in that case?
I think so. And it's an RNA virus, so they can mutate quite soon, like influenza, so you can repeatedly get infected by the new types of the viruses.
I read that there are currently, I think, there are already several strains of...
Several strains, but...
I don't know what strain means necessarily.
Yeah, so the nucleotide changes are there. Usually they happen every once a week or two, but they don't always result in amino acid changes. So in that case, the protein sequence is not differentiated. So I'm not certain if you can really say if they are differentiated enough to identify as different strains.
I guess what we want to know is whether they are so differentiated that a vaccine would not cover those multiple
kinds,
variations, or...
Yeah, but that also happens for influenza too.
Do you think that is likely? Do you think it's likely that if it takes so long to develop a vaccine, that there will be an additional...
So if there is a way to safely apply the vaccines, there are multiple ways to produce multiple antigens rapidly. So there are like mRNA vaccines or protein vaccines, just based on
アンティジェンじゃなくて抗原ですね。抗原ってなんて言うんでしたっけ。アンティジェンいいのか。アンティジェンでいいですね。あの、抗原部位になってるところの、変異したやつだけを、普通にバクテリアとかに人工的に作らせて、で、それを入れることによって、抗体作るとかっていう技術はできてきてるので、コロナウイルスに対してある程度安全に、ワクチンを提供できるという土台ができれば、 変異に対応することは、可能だと思います。だから、変わったとしても、それに、速やかに対応することは多分できるし、今はもうインフルエンザのワクチンっていうのは3個ぐらいの株の混合したものを打っていて、まあ、どれかが当たるでしょうっていうことでやってるわけなので、それを予測するのはそんなに多分難しくないので、ワクチンができるようになれば、今より全然多分コントロールできるようにはなると思います。
でもできるまでは相当時間かかるし、やっぱりグローバルになっちゃってるので、もう全部が抑えきれなかったら絶対そこから飛び火が続くわけですよね、
うん、
だからあのまあ今年の夏に終わるってことはないでしょ
う、
This is this the first time this has ever happened like this?
No, this is influenza outbreak that's happened, like the Spanish flu.
Was that global?
Yes.
On this scale as well?
Yeah.
Much
higher.
Was it this quick?
I am not sure because it's a century ago.
Because time,
it
seems
must be
to...
much more global, so we have much more flights flying around cities.
Right. That's what I would assume, that it was like faster this time, maybe.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I mean, I saw an article that said, like, in the UK, some team estimated that, like, 70% of the population is already infected or something, and that sounded... in a way optimistic to me.
I
like,
don't think
oh.
that's possible.
That sounds pretty 70%
high. 70% is not possible.
Yeah, that sounded really optimistic to me. Like, oh, then, you know, it's almost done. But,
well,
but yeah.
Yeah, the history of infections are very interesting. And some of these are spreading way too rapid. So the interesting things are like the sexually transmitted disease, which are brought from the New World, the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
They have spread all around the world in the order of months.
Mm.
Hmm.
It's only sexually transmitted.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
They're getting down.
It's how it shows how much we as humans have a interaction within the society. Yeah.
That's crazy.
So something that can spread with a cough, like in the coronavirus case, yeah, it's not that difficult to imagine. It can spread so fast. So in the case of the New World, they only have ships to travel around the world, but right now we have flights and everything. And
people are still flying here, right? I mean, as of right now.
Yes. So the government has asked for quarantine, self-quarantine for 14 days, but they don't provide places, they don't provide transportation, and they don't provide any compensations as of now. So
it's so crazy to me that they don't provide any transportation. So it's like, unless you know someone here who can drive you, or
if you can afford a hotel for 14
for
days.
For 2 weeks,
well,
yeah.
If the government can pay for that and make sure you don't infect additional people, it seems like a good use of money.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what Taiwan and other countries are doing.
Yeah.
They test immediately when you arrive at the airport, and then you are quarantined by government to some facility, and then you are regularly monitored for the infection by the PCR. Because
it feels like Japan is being so stingy on weird things.
We don't have much money. We are becoming a poor country.
Yeah, that's what it really feels like. If I look at other countries, like what other countries are doing... like Canada and Taiwan and whatever, like they seem like they have way more money. Like what?
We don't have a decent ruler,
right? Yeah.
Well, we had to spend a bunch of money on the Olympics. Remember?
And that's also a waste of money.
Yeah. It's just crazy to me. But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
but that is democratically. Elected president, so I mean prime minister. So,
well, it's evolution still, right?
It's not evolution.
Oh, it's not evolution.
Evolution is the survival of the fittest, but the current the cabinet is not probably the survival
the
of the fittest.
clearly not.
How do we explain this sort of like? Do you think that human beings have just totally broken away from evolution, or is evolution still like it's
happening?
Yeah, is it still happening?
Evolution is happening, but at a different time scale.
Do you believe that ideas are involved in evolution? Like ideas? So if I produce an idea and somebody else produces an idea, we have sort of survival or persist. The better idea generally will win. Or
the parameter for the fitness is very different from what organisms are experiencing in evolution, but there is some selection and mutation happening in cultures and human society as well. But it's not as comprehensive as what the life is experimenting on Earth, and the survival parameters are not that strict, or how do I say? So for life, the selection criteria is if they survive or not. So it's very clear cut. But for human cultures or human whatever or society issues or some things are not always set with a single criteria, and the criteria itself is changed. So it's a bit of a different thing.
Do you think there's a way to sort of explain our politics from an evolutionary lens, or we should just try to use more sociology? And
I think it's totally out of evolution. It's much more a narrow scale. And usually what gets to be selected as the right culture or right education or right anything is considered by the person in power, or the culture in power, or the nation in power, or the League of Nations in power. So it's more biased.
But how do we break away from evolution? Sorry to kind of go back into this this rabbit hole, but how did we break away from evolution, if that's what's happening?
That's just a time scale. So in terms of the things within the species, is always out of evolution. So whatever happens to a species, so the species of tardigrades or humankind as a species, is a unit in the evolution. So whatever happens within the unit is outside of evolution.
So the things that happen within the human species, it's outside of evolution?
It's outside the time scale of evolution, so yeah.
Do you think we need something like evolution as a framework to...
It's a very good optimization technology, so we use that a lot in computational science to optimize. Like genetic algorithm is the basic idea, where you create a lot of entities with different properties, so a lot of mutations happening in... a small number of mutations happening in a lot of individuals, and you put them into a single test, single selection criteria, and then you use the remaining generation to produce another type of mutations, and then keep doing it again. So it's an imitation of an evolutionary process. And this is known to overcome local minima or local maxima, and so they can search much broader solution space in a mathematical term to optimize in a very, how to say, larger perspective. So it's a good technology to use for optimization technology.
It's sort of like a virtual guess and check.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So it's very dangerous to put evolutionary thinking into sociology and things, because things like social Darwinism can happen.
Eugenics.
Yeah. So if you start thinking the selection criteria or the fitness criteria from the standpoint of the person in power, humans can easily use that as a excuse to perform very nasty things.
Like Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen that, right?
So I don't really like placing evolutionary thinking into a very small timescale things.
It's very tempting, you know, when you think about like competition and the survival of businesses, for example. You know, these are organizations, and they seem to have the only goal is for the organization to persist. It seems to mirror evolution.
Yeah, but how you persist can be a very different thing. So if you optimize on the market strategy, that can be fit for a very short time period, but that will be probably a long lasting, because nowadays you need more thinking about the sustainability of your business and also the business as a whole in the human society. And those parameters keep changing in a very short time in the human society. And what you put as a fitness parameter in the long term may not really benefit you economically in the short term. So it is a bit of a very difficult and sometimes dangerous thinking. So if you only think about the fitness, you really can distort the society. So, you know, making monopolies and eating up all the resources.
That's what I'm afraid AI is going to do.
I think they're much more smarter than humans in a few years. I mean, in a few decades. So they can do a better job.
So you think AI will sort of emerge as a power, like a very... In what form what do you think the limits of AI are?
So AI as an optimized agent and a free-thinking agent is a different thing. And I'm not sure free-thinking AI can be made, and the general AI can be made in a very narrow time points, like in one or two human generations. But optimized AI is already used anywhere, and it's getting very useful in many purposes. So, yeah, I think it can easily replace many of the small tasks, routine tasks done by lawyers, even the primary physicians, and those kind of things, yes.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that more and more. Maybe like security applications and, I mean, all over the place.
Yeah, all over the place.
You just see ads on TV. Every like iPhone app is like, yeah, it has Cinquecento in there.
And, Where did you learn English?
So I used to live mostly overseas until I came back for college. And I spent my middle school and high school years in American school. So I first lived in China, mostly in primary school years, and I went to Japanese school there. But when I moved to Switzerland, when I was in seventh grade, I went to American school, and then moved to United States, New York, from 10th grade to when I graduated in 12th grade. So the 6 years was in American school. So I'm kind of losing my English after the 20 years. No, 20 more years.
Yeah, your English is perfect. I thought I heard like an accent sometimes.
So I have two accents. So I first learned my English in Switzerland, which was a British accent.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It is. Yeah, I thought you were in UK.
Yeah. So
because
but after that, when I moved to New York, I got the American accent. So
I see.
They always tell me to I have the mix and
Yeah. One of my friends learned English while going to, I guess, a boarding school in Switzerland, and has the exact same accent. Yeah. I swear. Oh. Yeah.
Okay. So. Interesting.
So, I mean, Japanese is still your first.
Yes.
Your first language.
Yeah, I much prefer Japanese.
But on talking about very technical subjects, do you feel sometimes more comfortable in English or?
So, language is to me like using different versions of operation systems. So when I'm in the Japanese operation system, well, I'm much more comfortable speaking in Japanese. And then when I tend to speak English, I kind of think in Japanese and then express in English. But when I stay in Europe or in the United States for like 3 days, my English always turns on. And I tend to think in the English mode. So I speak much more fluent in English. But right now I'm in Japanese mode.
Do you think better in English or in Japanese?
It's not good or better. So it's in a different way. So how we think is really confined by the languages that we think. and with I think quite differently when I was in the Japanese mode or the English mode.
When you're thinking about like something very technical or scientific, do you prefer thinking in Japanese or
depends? So if you want a more I hate to say logic in this context, though. something. How do I say?
It makes the other one sound illogical.
Yeah.
No, but I totally know what you mean, though.
Yeah. So if you want to solve some problem in a nearsighted context, English mind thinking is much more optimized, I think, and in a way logical. But if you want to solve a more broad range information, you need to combine different disciplines and different ideas. And I think the Japanese or even the Asian kind of thinking context or the language context is more suited to link different ideas and combine them to form new ideas. And in the current biology, we really need to think about many different disciplines, so chemical way of thinking, computational way of thinking, physical way of thinking. And many places, I think the Japanese way of thinking really helps to explore that.
It's maybe more holistic or inclusive of other interplay between other disciplines.
I think that's kind of related to having the Yaoyorozu no Kami, so many different animistic gods in the universe, so we can respect everything, but it's more optimized if you have a single god and a single discipline.
Yeah, I feel like Japanese is more nuanced, like so sometimes I have to write something, like translate something from Japanese to English, but it's like Nihongo だったら例えばこう皆さんで頑張りましょうと、なんか皆さんでこのなんかなんだろうなんだろう共に手を取りなんちゃらみたいなとか、そういうのって英語にするともうなんかほぼ何も言ってないみたいな、
なんかね、あのシステムとしての考え方が多分一般的なんですよ。で、西洋圏だと個としての考え方が多分一般的で、個としてどう詰めるかっていう問題とシステムとして何かを捉えるっていうことっていうのが多分結構対立的なのかなというと思うんですよね。だから結構僕らはその宗教的にも自然と一体というような感じのことをあのアジアの方では考えがちなんだけど、その自然と一体ってものがしっかり多分定義できないから逆に結構嫌がるわけですね。で、どっちかというとヨーロッパの歴史とかっていうのは森を征服していくような歴史だったわけで、でどちらかというとアジアのホテルは森と共に生きていくっていうような、考え方だったわけで、その辺のこうどう捉えるかというところとシステムをどう捉えるかというところが多分一番違うのかなと。で、生物だとほとんどがシステムなので、意外とあの日本的な考え方は僕はマッチしてるんじゃないかなと思います。
面白い。
なんか個別の文章を考えるときにはね、あの逆に邪魔するときがあるので、英語の方がスペシフィックにあの物事を考える、曖昧性がなくなるので、何か あの機能とかってことを考えるときに日本語だと曖昧なままで分かった気になっちゃうんだけど、分かった気になれないので、あの
う、ね、
英語的に考えた方が、細かいことはしっかり詰められるかなと思いますね。
まあ、主語飛ばせますし ね、
そうですね、
日本語だからこうたまに日本の政治家のスピーチとか、これを多分英語にしたら本当に何も言ってない
みたいになっちゃう。
日本語でも何も言ってない
そう、そう、
But that doesn't prevent people from, you know, nodding and,
まあ、日本語だとなんとなくごまかせるというか、
Sometimes it's like it's just conveying a feeling or trying to get everyone to feel the same way about something without really saying that much.
Yeah.
But, yeah. There is a vagueness in Japanese, and there's a, I think there's less accountability. Just culturally, people are less concerned, I think, with hard evidence and like,
まあそうね、こう何々と聞いておりますとか言ったらそれでもう OK になっちゃうけど、それ英語で言ったらおかしいもんね。
あとは誤解を与えたというのであれば、謝ります
、謝ります、
謝っていない
そう、確かにそれも英語にするとかなり無理があるっていうか、誰にも受け入れてもらえないけど、日本語だとね、ふんわりなんか流してもらえるっていうか、
It's useful in that way also. I think it's sometimes it takes a lot of skill to be as vague as you are trying to be in English, it's much easier in Japanese. Yes.
Yeah. Way easier.
So we can be a better poet, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's why like things like haiku has really gotten into it. So with that number of words, we kind of express everything in the universe. That's only possible with the vagueness of the concepts, I guess.
And it allows people, I think, to refer to or remember their own experiences. So when you read haiku, that ambiguity is what lets you fill it in with your own memory, your own sort of sensations and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas in English, you read it, it's like very, it can seem quite literal and maybe less relatable for that reason.
Yeah, that's true. 確かに。何か宣伝するものとかあります？あの本とかぬいぐるみ。
まあ、ぬいぐるみはこう楽天とかアマゾンとかで、
あ、オンラインで
売ってますね。
What should they search?
リアルクマムシぬいぐるみとかで検索してもらったら、多分クマムシのぬいぐるみでも出てくると思いますけど。
これめっちゃ可愛いよ。
あとはその学研のキットですか？
あ、そうだ、そのキット。それめっちゃ欲しい。え、それはどこで売ってる？それもネットにあります。
多分どこでもあると思います。ミクロモンスターなんだっけな、出てきます。ミクロモンスターで検索すると多分出てきます。
Are you involved in that one?
Yes, so I helped developing the thing.
あ、Amazon にある。ミクロモンスター。
ただあのあれ印税式じゃなくて払い切り式だったので買ってももうお金は入ってこない。
あ、残念。LED 内蔵ズーム顕微鏡&調査キット。
電池が別売りっていうのはちょっとあの申し訳ない。
あ、なるほど。
ただそれで価格を抑えてて1800円かな。
うん、1900。
だいぶあの顕微鏡としては安い。
え、確かにめっちゃ安い。
え？ぜひなのでお子さんの自由研究とかあの困ってる人とか、あとは今ちょうど自宅待機でね、あのいい時期だと思うので、家で子供とあの、まあ、観察するとか、でクマムシじゃなくてもいろんなそういう固形の中とかにいるちっちゃな生き物って見るだけでも楽しいので、
これはめっちゃ欲しい。
So is this one the 30 magnification or?
Yes, so it has two magnifications. I forgot.
So 倍率は約50から80倍。
Ah, yes.
Wow.
It's a cheap microscope. So you need to have a little bit of a learning of technique to do it right. But it's good for observing tardigrades.
Do you need to have a slide or something? Or you just
slide is included.
Okay.
Yes. So
you should put the... Would you just put the moss directly on the slide?
So the instructions are open.
Okay.
Right in the box.
So we have a collection kit
where you put the moss and then on the water. And there's also spoit.
そうなんかほら、こういうセットになってるから、これちゃんと読んだらできる。
All the instructions are there and all my tardigrade pictures.
But it's easy to do, yeah. Like it's not.
Finding the tardigrades, you will need some experience. Yes. But basically, handling is not that difficult.
これ買おう。
ぜひ。
Yeah.
これ皆さん。
We need it.
ね、特にまあでも子供いなくても別にやりたいけどね。
Well, yeah, I mean, most people have not like seen that scale of the world with their own eyes. Maybe like when you're like
in school,
小学生 or something, you do, but you don't. You just kind of move on with your life after you find out about small stuff and
そう、あと YouTube で僕の名前で多分検索してもらうとあのいっぱいクマムシの動画上がってるので、あのもっと
そのリンクをシェアします。
YouTube ビデオで撮ったのがあるのでぜひそれも見てもらうと可愛さが分かるんじゃないかと。
インスタとかある？
インスタやってないですね。ツイッターはやってますけど、
Do you have any videos on there as well? Or?
So on Twitter? So I have a YouTube channel which has all my tardigrade images and videos.
じゃあそのリンクをみんなにシェアするのでぜひ。
はい。
かわいいクマムシみんな見てもらって。
なんかね目が合った気がする時があるんですよ。まあ気のせい。
はっ、こっち見てるみたいな。
そうそうそう。
見て何を思ってるのか。It's so cute. ありがとうございます。こんななんかいろんなお土産もいただいてしまって。
こちらこそありがとうございます。
またぜひ遊びに来てください。
はい。Thanks for answering all of our silly questions.
Interesting questions. At a very good time.
Yeah, me too. This is such a mysterious part of the world that we live in, and it's so cool that we could like just go look at it ourselves, confirm. Yes. You know, it's there are a lot of things in this world where we don't. The average person cannot go look at. You know, I don't know, an atom, but we can confirm it with our own eyes.
Oh yes,
yeah,
and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.